final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap!
Operator, give me the number for 911.
This is Clean Eyes, a portable television studio.
It's the end of time, and the Mississippi River, she's a gold grind. The interest is up and the stock market's down, and you're only getting mugged if you go downtown. I live back in the woods, you see, my woman and the kids and the dogs and me. Got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I can plow a field all day long. I can catch catfish from dusk till dawn. Make our own whiskey and our own smoke too. Ain't too many things these old boys can't do. We grow good old tomatoes and homemade wine, and country boy can survive.
Virginia coal mines and the Rocky Mountains and the western skies. And we can skin a buck, we can run a trot line, and a country boy can survive.
Country folks can survive.
I had a good friend in New York City. He never called me by my name, just Hillbilly. My grandpa taught me how to live off the land, and his taught him to be a businessman. He used to send me pictures of the Broadway nights, and I'd send him some homemade wine. But he was killed by a man with a switchblade knife. For $43, my friend lost his life. I'd love to spit some beach nut in that dude's eyes and shoot him with my old 45, 'cause a country boy can survive.
Country folks can survive.
North California and South Alabama and little towns all around this land. And we can skin a buck and run a trot line, and a country boy can survive.
Country folks can survive.
here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Okay, the next thing to talk about, since we were on the subject of fluorescent lighting earlier, and here's a fixture complete, are ballasts. Because a fluorescent lamp, or any discharge source, mercury vapor, sodium, neon, metal halide, they all require ballast because when current passes through mercury vapor is such a good conductor of electricity that the if the lamp were connected directly to the power source, it would, as it warmed up, it would draw more and more current as more mercury vaporized until eventually it would act almost like a short circuit. Chances are it would destroy the lamp. So the lamp cannot operate directly off of it, off of the AC line. It has to have a current limiter. It also has to have something that can supply a high voltage spike to start the lamp, which is also important, and supply the proper current to preheat the cathodes. So a ballast does three things. Here we have a ballast. This one is from the 1940s that I took all the tar out of because ballasts are filled with tar to make them run quieter and also to help dissipate heat. And this model is to run 2 4-foot 40-watt lamps. And you can see what all's inside of a typical fluorescent ballast. Here's your transformer section. You've got a step-up transformer on here, which steps 120 volts up to about 200 volts, to run actually about 216 volts, to supply enough voltage to run the lamps. Then you have two reactors, one for each lamp. That's what actually limits the current to the lamps, so they can't get too much current. They're called chokes. And then there's a third winding called a starting compensator, which I won't go into right now. And that's necessary for starting of one of the two lamps. You got a capacitor, which raises the power factor of the ballast. In other words, makes it draw less line amps because the capacitor modifies the characteristics of the ballast. It's kind of complicated, so I won't go into it in great detail. But this particular model has a capacitor, and this is in series with one of the two lamps that it operates. So basically, a ballast is a type of transformer combined with a current limiter. On the smaller fluorescents like this one, you have a simpler ballast. And this is it. This is what runs this lamp. It's a simple choke ballast, just like what's in the big ballast, except it doesn't need a step-up transformer, and it doesn't use a capacitor. So all it has is just a choke in series with the lamp. And this does everything. It limits the current to the lamp, so it can't get too much current. It provides the inductive kick to start the lamp, and it limits the current through the cathodes during preheat. So this ballast does three things all in one little unit. And it's just a simple little coil with two wires in series with the lamp. Here we have some other formats. This is a ballast from the early 1940s, early to mid-1940s. This one's called a long John ballast or a thin section ballast. This one runs 240-watt fluorescent lamps as well, 4-foot lamps. But it's long and narrow. And the reason for it was some of the light fixtures in that era were really streamlined and really thin. And the area where the ballast mount in the center, the trough where the ballast go, was very narrow and thin. So they had to make a long, skinny ballast in order to fit into that space. These type are actually getting hard to find these days because they don't make them anymore. And this particular model is just like the one I showed the innards of, but complete. And this is the most typical ballast that was used right up into the early 50s. Preheat for 240-watt fluorescent lamps, 4-footers. And this one's made by Westinghouse, which is a nice feature. You don't see as many Westinghouse ballasts. But this is what's known as a brick ballast, and you can see why, because it's big and heavy. And it weighs about 8 pounds. Occasionally, when these ballasts get old, the windings will short out inside, and they'll start to overheat, and they'll start to smoke, and they'll start to leak tar. And, you know, in a few rare cases, they can even catch fire if the failure mode is ignored and the light is left on. The ballast can completely burn up and start a fire. It's rare, though. It's really kind of rare considering how many ballasts are in use. But I've seen many of these overheat and start to smoke at the end of their life. The smoke is coming from one of these windings burning up inside the ballast. They don't all just burn up like that. If they're well cared for, they'll last a lifetime. And then as time progressed, they got smaller. This is a two lamp for 2 4-foot lamps as well, 40 watt, rapid start ballast. And this particular case design is what they're using today, even on the new electronic ballasts, are pretty much the same case style. And this ballast is what replaced the old ballast, but this one doesn't need starters. The older ones needed starters, where the newer ones don't. It's called rapid start. It'll start the lamps without starters. It uses a combination of high voltage and constant cathode preheat, but it also has a lot more wires to hook up, so that's one of the disadvantages. Plus, these aren't as reliable as the old preheat ones. In fact, anyone that has these old preheat lights in use should keep them because they're really good lights. They're really dependable. Okay, on the subject of ballasts, I have a big twisty compact fluorescent bulb here. And this one shows pretty much how a modern electronic ballast is done. It's just a printed circuit board with a transformer. This is what actually runs the lamp. Some transistors, which make an inverter circuit to invert 60 Hertz AC to high frequency AC to run the fluorescent lamp. Some capacitors and resistors and diodes as part of the circuit. Pretty simple device. You know, it's not that complex as electronic circuits go. And it's a rapid start circuit, which is the same as the rapid start magnetic ballast I have here. But you can see it's much more compact. And this is for the compact fluorescent, so it's made round. And where a ballast, its efficiency is judged by how much losses it has, because the ballast has to limit the current to the lamp. And in doing so, some of the energy has to be lost in the ballast. It's just the laws of physics. So the losses of a ballast are expressed in watts. For example, a 2-lamp ballast like this one, preheat one, will lose about maybe 15 watts of power to run 240-watt lamps. So that ends up being about 85 watts or so of total current consumption for the 2 lamps and ballast. Now on this ballast, it's the same idea. It's electronic. It's a little more efficient to run the lamp at high frequency over standard 60 cycle frequency, but the only efficiency boost comes in the lamp itself, not the ballast. The ballast still has losses. This one on this big CFL probably loses at least 10 watts. But one thing the old magnetic ballast has that the electronic ballast does not, the old magnetic ballast will last 50 years if it's cared for. The new electronic ballast will only last the lifetime of this lamp. And the ones that run the straight tubes in this kind of a case, if they last 5 years, they're doing good. When an old magnetic burns out, you can recycle it easily as scrap metal. When these burn out, yeah, they may take it as electronic scrap at a junkyard. But not many junkyards want them because they're not even worth the effort to recycle.
Crap!
Operator, give me the number for 911.
Hello, everybody. You're listening to Mad Science on www.shazizradio.com. If you want to join in on the chat, jump over there to www.shazizradio.com/superchat.html, and you can join in on the Wake Radio side chat room and the Shaziz Radio side chat room all in one shot. So anyway, I posted several videos over there. Probably have to scroll up on the Shaziz Mad Science one. The chat rooms are hopping over there. Anyway, I posted a video yesterday. It's a pretty long video, but if you pay attention to it, it's a pretty interesting anomaly that I'm working with on there. It's called Electromagnet. And what essentially I did was I took a little transformer, which was a step-down transformer. It's 120 volts AC at 60 hertz and drops it down to 9 volts AC. Well, the transformer itself, the primary coil in the transformer went bad. And so I was pretty much left with a piece of junk. So I got an idea. I'm going to go ahead and do a video using that core. So I took my Dremel and I cut the little spot welds that they used to hold the core together and pulled the thing apart and cut loose the primary on the thing. And that was kind of fun because it kind of welded itself together from the heat. But either way, I was managed to able to save the secondary on there. And so in the process of taking this thing apart and using it, testing it out to make an electromagnet to do a video on it, it reminded me of the magnetic ballast that they use in fluorescent lighting systems. And so with that said, it kind of added a little bit more to the video. Is instead of just about electromagnets, it also has to do with electronic ballast, or magnetic ballast, sorry about that. Anyway, what I was able to do in this video was to take this concept that I used to make the electromagnet and the knowledge from the magnetic ballast and be able to use a motor from a tattoo gun to capture the collapsing field of the ballast itself, or the electromagnet. Whenever you let off the power, there's actually stored energy in there that will be released, and so essentially what you end up with when the tattoo motor is running up and down, as the field is expanding and collapsing, you can capture that energy and basically run a string of fluorescent, not fluorescent, probably could run fluorescent. It's just the frequency at which you're energizing that gas, but I ran a 120 volt strand of LEDs using the collapsing field on this deal along with the electromagnet. So essentially with a 9 volt battery, I was running a strand of LEDs and a tattoo gun motor and a electromagnet. Keep in mind, this is like I said, it's a long video, but it's worth the watch. It's actually a message at the end of it for everybody. But the key to take away from that particular video is that you can use any transformer. It doesn't matter what size this transformer is, old microwave oven transformer. If the secondary's gone bad, you can actually still find a use for that. You know, if you want to build your electromagnet, you just simple follow what I said in that video. You cut the top of that thing off, and you don't need the primary on there. If the primary is bad, you can take it off, or you don't even have to really modify it. But the key to this is that by pulsing this these coils with DC current, when the energy goes in and basically energizes it, basically turns it into an electromagnet, you've got a field as long as that current's on there. The moment you pull the power off of that, the field collapses, and on the way back you can capture that energy. See, in a fluorescent lighting system, they use these magnetic ballasts in series with the light bulb, which essentially acts as a choke and kind of steps the voltage up a little bit on one side of it. But the way that I'm actually running this thing, it's basically doing the same exact thing that you would do if you had a primary and a secondary on one transformer. See, when you pulse the primary, that fluctuating field sends the magnetic flux lines in through the secondary, which energizes it, and according to the number of turns of windings on there, will either step the voltage up or step the voltage down. So you're either going to raise the pressure of the voltage, or you're going to lower the pressure and get more current out of the secondary. But this method, you don't have to have a secondary. You're actually using the basically the flyback or the back EMF or the collapsing of the field to amplify that voltage. You can take any 9-volt battery and you can put it on, it doesn't even have to be 9-volt, you can actually do it with any DC battery, a little 1.5-volt battery, do the same. It's just the stronger the voltage, the more powerful the effect is going to get, which you also see in there because I show the difference when I run it with a 12-volt system as far as turning that electromagnet stronger, where I actually turned it upside down and then... when I hit it, you could see that it would lift the little metal piece off the top of the table, and then when I released it, you could watch it drop, which in itself is another effect that actually could be used to modify something. So, anyway, the key is, if you have old transformers, and you want to step up some voltage, you can actually build a circuit using transistors or MOSFETs or even a mechanical oscillator that will basically do what Tesla did back in the day. You know, Tesla was taking the knife switch and he would open it and close it real quick and he'd get these big spikes in energy. And so that's essentially what this is doing. You know, a lot of people do little toroids, or they do jewel thief circuits where essentially it's using basically the same process in order to pick this energy up and actually get the most energy you can out of a little single pin light battery, AA or AAA, either one. So it's a worthy anomaly to actually look into, because if you build the right circuit, you can actually amplify the energy that you're using by grabbing the energy that as the field is collapsing on the way back out. And so with that said, using some knowledge that we got in electronics and plumbing and stuff like that, you know, it's obvious that if you got an electronic circuit, you only want the energy to go out to pulse the coil. You don't want that energy being able to come back into the circuit, and the higher the energy gets, inevitably turns around and destroys the circuit. So if you have a solid state circuit that has a one-way valve, like a regular valve on a plumbing system, or it only allows the pressure to go one way, it's like called a check valve, I believe, but it won't allow it to come back the other way. It's the same thing that a diode would be for your electronic circuit. So if you have some heavy duty diodes that won't allow high voltage to come back the other direction, you have the transistor pulsing the coil, and as the magnetic field is collapsing, it sends a spike out the other side. So in this case, like they're doing with flyback transformers, you wouldn't have to have a secondary on there. As a matter of fact, if you did it right, you wouldn't even need a flyback transformer at all. You could just do it with one single coil and one core. So, you know, with that said, take a look at that video. I also put in a couple videos about some different ballast and some grow light kind of technology, and basically give you an explanation of different ways that they run. One of them is it shows the difference between a magnetic ballast and electronic ballast, where the guy shows you can take a cell phone and you can name it at the magnetic ballast one, and you can see where there's actually a break in the lighting that's going on. You can see like a candy stripe all the way around the bulb when it's running, whereas the other one is using a high frequency and a high voltage and maintaining it straight. So that's another interesting anomaly to take a look at if you're going to be doing like grow lighting and stuff like that for aquaponics or hydroponics or whatever. And the last one was the pod that I just played here on the radio show, which basically gave you a brief rundown about all the different types of ballast, all the way back to the old style ballast and so on and so forth. The ballast in themselves are pretty much wasting a lot of energy. They figured that out a long time ago, and they went from the big giant bulky ballasts that you see that are filled up with tar down to these little tiny magnetic ballast. Because they didn't need all that extra stuff in there to be able to light the fluorescent bulbs up, and that made them a whole lot more efficient. You're not wasting all the energy trying to maintain a primary, which is pulsing a secondary, which also has a choke in there and a capacitor to smooth it out. And basically, he said the tar inside there was to quiet it down and keep it from overheating, to try to disperse some of the heat off of the deal. Well, if it was done right, we've seen before, you can take a Slayer exciter circuit, which is like a tip 42C transistor, a resistor, and a couple diodes, and a couple coils, and bam, you got a high frequency that can energize the gas wirelessly in a fluorescent bulb and light it up. So the modern day electronic ballasts are more along the realm of the Slayer exciter circuit that energizes those bulbs and basically lights them up. You don't have to have all the preheater portions of it, because it instantaneously starts to energize that gas. And not to mention, Justin said in the chat room, they're like 10 times smaller. Anyway, I'm going to be giving Justin a call here pretty quick. He's got some things to share with you on some of his writings that he's been doing. Anyway, so with that said, if you've got some old transformers and you want to step some voltage up a little bit, you want to get some higher voltage going on, now keep in mind, what I'm talking about isn't running your house off of this reaction. Now, it's all these pieces of the puzzle. If you take these pieces of the puzzle and you know that you can do this with a magnetic ballast, and you step this up or scale it up to a larger scale, and you got bigger coils that can handle higher current and higher voltage and that kind of stuff, and using capacitor technology, if you take a look inside of the magnetic ballast, the electronic ballast that they got going on these days, you can see pretty much the same thing that I'm talking about, and that's on a smaller scale, a solid state kind of electrical deal. But they're using 120 volts initially to energize this. But if you go actually through the schematic of this, I'm sure you're going to find out that it doesn't take near that much energy to run these things as that is necessary to get out on the other side for what you want to use. So with that said, I've got a few of those old electronic ballasts around here that I'm going to try to do a few experiments on and see where the point is where I can cut out the 120 volts AC and cut in with something like 12 or even 9 volts to see whether or not I can pulse these things and get good results out the other side. So the older ballast, even those are worth salvaging if you ever come across them, because you could use the same technique, pulsing the primary with smaller voltages to raise that voltage up. And once again, I'm not talking about running your entire house off of ballast. I'm just talking about using this concept, this anomaly, to actually design any system that you work for. It's like this. All the way in through your entire house, there are electrical appliances that are using way more energy than it actually takes to get the function out, such as a 9-volt AC clock. You've got 120 volts running in to step down to a 9-volt AC. Well, in the process of doing that, that 120-volt primary is getting hot, which is causing you losses. And so that is not even necessary. If you can run it directly off the 9 volts AC that you needed to begin with, then you didn't need the whole 120 in order to do it. And that's what this guy was talking about, how these things had major losses in them because of the way that they're designed. Now, Raymond has showed with his LED lighting system that he's been working with. I got a call here. How you doing, Thomas? You're live on air. Oh, wow. You should have had your coffee before you came alive on air, man.
It's not brains. It's caffeine.
Man, we've been zombie attacked by Thomas over here. How you doing there, brother? Well, hold on. I think you're not doing so well if you're feeling like that.
Yeah, I need something to wake me up. But I'm here. Okay.
At some point, Justin wants to be added in here 5 minutes from now or something like that. So, yeah, I think Steve's out hunting trolls. So,
Steve's out hunting trolls.
Yeah. All right. So anyway, what I was talking about was a video that I just posted out there in the chat room about electromagnets. Called the video "Electromagnet." I basically showed how you can actually turn just any transformer into an electromagnet. It's really simple. But in the process of doing this, I got a decent anomaly that was worthy of looking into further, which had to do with magnetic ballasts and how they function. See, a magnetic ballast that they put into modern-day fluorescent lighting, it's run in series with the light bulb in the AC current. And essentially, it's a choke. It basically restricts the flow because, believe it or not, those ballasts, if you can't slow down the energy going into that bulb, they'll actually keep on amplifying themselves to the extent where they'll finally burn that bulb out and damage the entire system. So, you know, what they determine as a hindrance, I determine as a plus, because I want as high a voltage as I can get. I don't care how long that thing sits there. If it whips out a lightning bolt, I'll be happy. So, anyway, in the process of doing this this electromagnet video out of a it's a 120 volt at 60 hertz AC transformer, drops it down, step down transformer to 9 volts AC, doing a few tests, and basically shocked the crud out of myself, and I said, "Eureka, I got an idea." So, essentially, I took an old tattoo gun, which is essentially a solenoid. The same concept for the electromagnet is how the solenoid works, or there's also relay switches that do the same exact thing. And the same exact concept, when the field is expanding to create the electromagnet, as long as you hold the power on steady, that power's still there. All right, but when you drop that, take the wire loose, and that field collapses, that energy being released out can be grabbed on the way back out. Some people call it back EMF, and they use it in things like jewel thieves and toroids and stuff like that. And so, instead of using one of these ballasts in series with a fluorescent bulb, if you used it in parallel, you can get the same result. The only problem why they run them in series is because these things will, you know, the faster you pulse them, the higher that voltage flyback will become, to the point where it'll actually destroy the bulb. You see what I'm saying? Is that too technical? Are you awake? Thomas ain't feeling so well today. Alright, well, anyway, so take a look at that video. It's posted over there on YouTube. It's called Electromagnet, and it's also posted over in the chat room on shazizradio.com/superchat.html. And this is just one of the many anomalies that could be used to actually build a really decent device out there, you know, alternative energy. Once you know how these things work, see, when you got an electromagnet going on with the 9 volts DC battery, and you're sitting there and you're holding that thing on there, as long as you hold that on there, you got essentially a direct dead short through that coil, and it'll drain that battery down pretty doggone quick. And that's one of the problems I kept having with the process. But now with a the open and closing circuit, such as a transistor or even a MOSFET or a mechanical oscillator, you're only tapping on there just long enough to spike up the voltage going in, and then when it releases, it's going to get that back EMF, that extra spike on the way back out. So you end up with the equivalence of AC current. That's how I was able in this video to run a 120-volt strand of LEDs with it. And with the right circuitry, you could use something like a potentiometer to basically turn the frequency up and down to where you can adjust it to where it's just right for whatever your needs are going to be. But either way, it's a pretty cool little deal that come up out of basically a tragedy when my 9-volt AC transformer burned up on me. So the primary went bad, but I was still able to find a secondary purpose for the remaining portion, which was the secondary, the 9-volt AC winding side of it. You could do this with any transformer. It doesn't matter how big it is or how small it is. You can actually, in reality, do this with stator motors. The stator out of there is the equivalent of that electromagnetic ballast. And you can try it sometime. Get you a stator motor and tap it on there with a battery, and you'll see that whenever that field collapses, it sends a jolt right back to you. So the energy goes in, and for every action, it's an equal and opposite reaction, and it'll come out. And the faster you pulse that up there, the higher that voltage return will be, because you're not giving that thing a chance to fully collapse and level out before you stop pulsing it. Which is essentially exactly how the Tesla coil functions, is that you're pulsing the primary, it sends the field up, before the field in the secondary gets a chance to collapse, you hit her again, and it keeps stepping that voltage up until, you know, it builds up on the top load and finally explodes out in those nifty sparks that everybody likes to see. So, you got anything to add to that there, Thomas?
No.
So what's on your agenda? What you got going on these days?
Trying to get people who say they're wanting to do something to fix the world to get together with me outside of the radio shows.
Yeah. Hint, hint.
Somebody was unreachable all week this week, even though we talked about getting together and getting a round robin going where we were going to actually do something. But
well, in my defense, I did come on there a couple of times, but you guys weren't on there, so we were kind of missing everybody. When we get off the air, I'll have to give you my home phone, that way you can call me up and throw that down there.
Oh, I don't know if it's your home phone number, but I have a number. I just felt it would be rude to try to call you on that. We said we were going to meet on Skype, so I checked on Skype.
No, a simple reminder, even via text, would be good, because I got like 10 billion projects going on at any given time. I was actually supposed to do a radio show with a friend of mine over Awake Radio, not Awake, Shake and Wake, and that kind of got blowed out of the water. Some family issues came up, and it's like everybody's got a drama on the side, and if you happen to walk through, you get drug in, so you know what I mean?
Yeah. See, the opposite of the Ferengi rule of acquisition about exploiting family.
Yeah.
It's still exploitation begins at home, but it's the family exploiting you instead of you exploiting them.
Yeah, I just happened through to get my cup of coffee, and the dilemma began. I'm like, I was getting ready to do something, but I can't remember what it was now because I've done been so distracted.
My first response, whenever they start screaming, would have been, who's feeling like, you know, they don't matter because no one's paying any attention to them? What's going on here?
Yeah. Hold on, I got to add Steven here. Unless you think you can do it. Let me try it. Do-do-do-do-do. Add Steve. Hang on there, buddy. I'll get you in there. We might as well go ahead and add Justin in there, too, while we're at it.
While we're at it, let's add everybody to Facebook, too.
Facebook?
We'll see how fast Steve disappears. he sent me a link that Firefox went, whoa, this is a registered attack site. Get me out of here. So I did a little Google search on it and found a Facebook page for it and threw it up there. And he kind of gave me a rash about going to Facebook. Well, I don't want a keylogger by going to the site you sent me the link for.
Well, you know, I'll tell you what. In this day and age, I think everybody and his brother out there spying on you. So that's probably why, you know, they keep changing all these operating systems on the computer so they can get better spyware and outdo the other guy by blocking their spyware.
Yeah. You figure out how to disable all the spying on Windows, and by the time you do that, they're trying to force another update on you.
Yeah, I got this stupid nag screen that just drives me flat out batty that keeps talking about renew my antivirus, you know, every 5 minutes. It says got a little deal popped up and it says an option, remind me later. So you push on the remind me later and then 5 minutes later it's at you again.
Go in your control panel and disable that completely. Disable updates.
Sure is. At least they do what they say they're going to do.
Nag you?
Back to what you were saying about being unavailable. There are certain people that live on the other side of the planet, Shaziz.
Yeah.
That have to sell their firstborn child to use normal telecoms to communicate. That's why we use Skype.
Well, look. Go watch, if nothing else, watch the very last portion of my video Electromagnet, and you'll see what kind of unfortunate circumstance I found myself in. And it's really obnoxious, man, because I figure at some point in time the laws of physics going to kick in, or there's going to be a little gust of wind, or maybe a slight earthquake or tremor or something like that, and OSHA's is going to be buried underneath everybody's junk, you know,
like TNT bag.
Yeah. What? No.
No.
Oh, man.
My wife was listening earlier.
She's lying, man.
My good lady wife was listening earlier, and she made a suggestion.
Yeah?
Perhaps you could arrive at an epiphany without electrocuting yourself.
Yeah, that would be a plus.
Just do it like old Doc Brown and get whacked in the back of the head.
Whatever floats your boat, but she was suggesting that perhaps electrocution wasn't the best way to arrive at a new idea.
Well, I'm going to have to say I tend to agree with her.
I'm sorry about that link I sent. I usually very carefully check stuff, so I'll put my hand up for that one.
Well, there were people on that Facebook page that were asking how they could add pages, because apparently that site allows you backdoor access to these science papers that they normally want to charge you a fee to get to. And, of course, you never get anything for free without a hitch coming with it when you look online. Anything they say, oh, it's free. No, they're getting ready to do something to you one way or another. Some of them it's acceptable because they're just going to basically throw an ad up on the page or something. You can get an ad blocker, you know, and most ads aren't really dangerous, but they're just annoying. But the other thing I noticed was that, you know, they were complaining saying it wasn't working, and the people were like, yeah, we're still working on putting it together. So it's still a fairly new site. I have a feeling they're not using a proper URL, and that's why it's giving me the warning.
I hate those mousetrap sites.
Those mousetrap sites?
Yeah, the ones where you stumble on them to check something out. You know, you do like a Google search, and you're looking for something, and you stumble on this site, so you click on the link. Then once you get on the doggone link and you don't like the deal because ads keep popping up everywhere and you keep trying to hit the back button, but they got the back button via JavaScript or whatever they got disabling the back button, and so you can't even get off the doggone site. Now, you can reach up there and click the home button and get out of there, but either way, it's aggravating.
Well, if it's using JavaScript to disable the back button, it'll disable the home button eventually. They'll figure a way out to do that. I would say just kill the whole process in Task Manager, and then when you restart it, Firefox gives you the option to unselect tabs, just unselect that tab.
Oh yeah, speaking of Firefox, I'm going to have to check that out for my XP system, because now I got a nag screen on the doggone Google Chrome that says that here pretty soon that no longer be any updates for Google Chrome for XP. They're just trying their doggonest to try to kick the XPs to the curb, man. You know, you get used to an operating system, and then suddenly either Microsoft or somebody wants to mess with it. Like, I loved Windows 98. That was one of my favorite ones, you know. I got to learning it really good, and by the time I got to learning it really good, the next version came out, and then all the doggone the updates that they had going on, the service pack ones and twos and threes and tens or whatever.
The next one, he's talking about Millennium.
Yeah.
That was the first huge mistake they put out.
Yeah.
And then they repeated the mistake with Vista.
My grandpa used to say, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Now, you get used to running a software program, and then they turn around and throw an update on there. It's like, YouTube does this all the time. You know, when YouTube very first started out, it was cool as heck, man. It was like a community. You could actually go talk to other video makers and people out there, and you had friends, and you had a friends list and all that, and then they started changing stuff and moving buttons, and now your friends list was somewhere else, and then finally it wasn't there at all, and all the different ways that you used to have like this community to communicate back and forth with each other, it got harder and harder to talk to other researchers out there because of that. And you know, Facebook did it as well. Now
it's all on Google Plus.
Yeah,
they moved all those features to Google Plus because they were trying to compete with Facebook. They saw how much money Mark Zuckerberg was making. They wanted a slice of that because they knew that he was making that money because he had power over people.
Well, when
they have admitted wanting to implant a chip in people's head.
Dang.
They were like, we wouldn't do that because that'd be creepy until the technology's available.
Good luck with that.
Like, what? Until what? Why did you add that little bit? Until the technology is available.
Well, you remember the whole Google Glass thing?
Mm-hmm.
Where they had these glasses that you could wear around. Whatever happened to that?
I don't know. I have a
I think
friend in Berlin
get
that said
heads punched in.
Yeah, that's what I was getting ready to say. Is I have a friend in Berlin that said, you come around him with any Google Glass, he's already warned you. You're getting punched. He's going to break the things right then and there because he is not giving you permission to put him, online.
Wow, cool. Well, I'd say if you're going to wear some of them Google glasses, it'd get you a hockey mask to cover up, or one of them like catcher mask with the grill on the front.
That
finishes it. I know a few members of the community in England that probably would do quite well with a hockey mask and a machete. Because that is their psychological profile.
Man.
And
quite, you could talk about the Queen like that. Oh.
Possibly, yeah. But quite unexpectedly, my friend came out with a burst of eloquence that said that if you come round to my place wearing Google Glass, it's going to save a trip to your proctologist.
Well, you know, ironically enough, there is a plus to that Google Glass. If I could actually get a hold of a pair of those, that'd be cool in the lab. That's the only place I'd ever be, would be in the lab with it. I wouldn't take and walk around with it. I'd just use it in the lab. That way you could see exactly what I'm looking at, you know, wherever I turn my head, you could see it. So, you know, that would be cool. But as far as, you know, going out there in public, unless you want to do one of them reality shows like you're getting punched in the face because somebody don't want to be on the internet.
It'd be the first generation of that idiocracy thing, punched in the face, man.
Yeah.
And eventually it would devolve into kicked in the balls, man. What would be the intermediary?
I'm not sure.
Punched in the gut, the breath knocked out of you, man?
Yeah, because you'd actually see the projectile vomiting once you got punched in the gut.
Shaziz, could you imagine what would happen if the general scientific community got hold of Google Glass for their lab experiments? I mean, the same people that can't find their glasses because they're on top of the head already are the ones that forget to switch it off when they go for a comfort break. You can't turn them off. That was a complaint. You can't turn them off.
That could be bad. But anyway,
well, you can with a hammer.
As long as you use them in the lab, I think they'd be awesome, you know, if the researchers were just using them in the lab. And then if you couldn't find them, all you had to do is go over and look at your computer and see what it's looking at.
I'd just say you break the contract and root those suckers.
Bury them?
Jailbreak them.
Jailbreak them.
Oh, cool.
Oh, I mean, why do you need Google Glass for that, though? If you seriously want something like that for the lab, you need to set up a GoFundMe and then go ahead and, using the money from that, literally, like, you know, let people know on the GoFundMe that you're going to basically build a headset that people can watch what you're doing. It's wireless, and you can get a wireless IP cam.
Huh.
So all you need to do is just basically have a little battery pack on your belt or whatever, and run a little cable up to it, and use that to link into your router so that it can broadcast online.
Yeah,
Tom,
cool.
I actually set up an IP cam on my horticultural growth system about 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Was it wireless?
All I got. It was wired into the PC, but it was an IP cam fixed to a specific IP address, so okay. People could watch the plants grow under artificial light.
Right.
And I got so many negative comments where it was just nothing happening. I said, well, it does take a month. The point of the 24-hour stream is so you can check in it on a weekly basis.
Right. This is what it's up to.
You know what you need to say nothing's happening.
Right, you know what you probably should be saying is if they're going to fall asleep while they're watching that, then, you know, go do something else, like, I don't know, putting together an auto check-in app that basically checks on it and saves a capture every hour. It takes a snap. And then it puts it all together, so it take there are 30 of those hour once an hour snaps every second being played off to put a what do they call that? There's a term for it. Time elapse. So they put a video together, you know.
Yeah. I did a 240-320 snapshot every 15 minutes for 3 months.
You know,
I had 1.5 terabyte hard drive. And when it was finished, the hard drive failed.
Dang.
That's why you use the cloud. Use the cloud, man. You don't care if anybody's seeing it, obviously, if you're streaming it online.
You know what would be cool? That some of these Adreno circuits that they've been working with have the capabilities of doing like a remote. Let's say you could actually adjust the camera from, you know, your computer. And you can look around my lab, you know, move it left and right and so on. Wouldn't that be cool?
Mm-hmm.
If you combine an Arduino with a Raspberry Pi, you have the power of a cell phone with a programmable, what do we call it?
Which I call it?
Programmable...
Are you talking about for, like, robotics?
Yes.
Don't need that. PiBot. $60.
No, the point being, that's what an Arduino is. It's a programmable microprocessor.
Right. Well, that's what I'm saying, is it's not so much programmable with PiBot, but PiBot is designed, it's a Raspberry Pi that has the added features to, on the single board, that gives you the ability to output all the signals you need for controlling a bunch of stepper motors. Which are what the primary thing everybody uses for robotics.
Do you know, in 1990, I was working as a computer sales executive. I was 18 years old. And the 486 chip was the kind of the big... Well, they were just getting into the phase of the 586 chip. And I went to an engineering company, and they were using a Commodore 64 as a robotics controller.
Cool.
And the guy said to me, if you find anybody that's got these, we'll buy them because we can program them. Now, isn't that cool?
You can still find the Commodore 64s and the TRS-80s. And actually, crazy enough, they actually, you can still, if you look around hard enough, you can still find the old 8 baud modems.
I threw a link in there, by the way.
You can still find a Sega Mega Drive, but why would you want to?
I don't know. They're fun to tinker around with. Anyway, back to the mad science issue at hand. These magnetic ballasts, one of the things that you were talking to me about a while back about light spectrum, Steve, for your agriculture. That's what this guy was talking about in one of these video links that I showed. I think it was the one with the platinum and the gold magnetic ballast going on, electronic or magnetic, one or two. But anyway, it's pretty fascinating how that light spectrum works. You got any knowledge you want to share with people on that?
Yeah, you can grow stuff with it.
Ha! Well, that was just really good. No, I think it more along the lines is, if this has got a cleaner frequency, at a certain frequency you get, some really good light for growing, but at a worse frequency, not so good, you still get the light, you can still see without stubbing your toe, but you're not going to be able to grow nothing with it very well.
Well, to break it down into simple terms, you have a light spectrum that's measured in nanometers. And it goes from about 450 nanometers, which is a blue spectrum, to about 750 nanometers, which is a red spectrum. You need the blue spectrum for your primary germination sequence, which will bring the plant up to the point where it starts producing flowers. That's usually, with most plants, about a month. It could be a month to 6 weeks, depending on what particular species or genus of plant you're using. After that, you want to move into the red spectrum, because the red spectrum itself will give the plant the correct, light spectrum for photosynthesis to start creating flowers. From flowers come fruit, and then you get your yield and your harvest. But that's kind of the absolute basic fundamental of it. And the reason why they use electronic ballasts, and I used a couple of different types of Lumitech ballast. I don't like to plug particular companies, but these were really, really reliable. And you can get it from a 250 watt, in fact I think you can get it even smaller, up to 1000 watt, so 1 kilowatt. The 600 watt is the most efficient though, for most plants that you grow. I mean, I grew chilies, peppers, cucumbers, pumpkins. Can you believe that? Grew pumpkins indoors, never saw a sign of daylight, and wow. they were quite good actually. I actually grew square pumpkin shizzes. That's mad science for you.
Yeah,
growing square pumpkins. You get a cinder block, which is like a block with two large cavities in it, about 4 to 6 inches by 4 to 6 inches, depending on the size of it. I think you call them fire blocks in the US. I'm not sure. But you put the flower of the pumpkin as it starts to develop on the vine over the top of this cavity in the block, and as the pumpkin starts to grow, gravity pulls it down into the cavity, and as it expands it hits four square corners.
Cool.
So it grows square. Now, I would advise people to use plastic casing with this, because you don't need a hammer to get your pumpkin out. But that's mad science, isn't
it? Yeah, that is pretty cool, man. There was a long time ago, one of these old Karate Kid movies, old Mr. Miyagi, he trained a bonsai tree. There's actually a tradition where they do this, where they actually train the tree to shape it, and to keep it down to a certain size. It's pretty amazing, where it looks like a scale model of a full-size tree. You ever seen those? Bonsai trees?
Oh, of course. I mean, I was born in 72. Do you think I didn't grow up with the Karate Kid?
Yeah, well, either way, I just thought that was cool how he was able to shape that tree, to train it on how to grow and how tall to be and all that kind of stuff. Some of those, I understand, are worth a lot of money, too.
She says, if you want to plant a hazel hedge, an oak hedge, or any kind of border around your garden, all you've got to do is to put a piece of plastic sheeting underneath the root ball of the plant, and the plant won't grow any bigger than the root ball underneath it. And if you put a barrier between itself and external earth, I mean, eventually it will punch through this plastic barrier, but it will create a diminutive plant, because the roots can't expand. And if you look at an oak tree, the canopy on above the ground of an oak tree is usually a mirror image of the root system underneath it.
Wow.
So if you've got a massive, great big oak tree with maybe, I don't know, anything up to 100-foot wide canopy, you can guarantee that the root ball underneath it is pretty much a mirror image. So if you have a house within 100 feet of an oak tree, you want to be pretty careful about what condition your foundations are in.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing.
Well, I mean, this is something
it's something I learned from the landscape
gardening, is that if you want a nice little hedge around the front of your garden, you dig as deep as you want the plant to grow high.
That's not so like something when you put that plastic down, you put maybe put two layers down and put some root kill in between them, so that way if it tries to poke through it, it basically ends up burning the end of the root off. That way it doesn't pierce all the way through both barriers.
That's been tried, unfortunately, Tom. When you put root kill in it, the roots draw it up into the plant.
Hmm.
So it tends to kill the whole plant.
Yikes.
Use root kill in pipes and stuff like that. They have roots in and it didn't kill the whole tree. How's that work? Is that just like a timing thing or something?
I guess I don't know what they were doing.
So
I've actually experimented that with myself, Tom. I've got two layers of plastic and I've put a root kill in between the two layers of plastic, powder, liquid, and some sort of weird looking pellet. And what's happened is, once it's gone up into the root system, the root system basically draw everything into the plant main stem, and first it will turn yellow, and that's kind of a warning sign, because the roots are a bit like drinking through a straw.
Right.
If there's anything in the ground, it's going to come up into the plant.
I over fertilized and fried my plants out before.
I'm wondering if instead of the root kill, you could lay down like steel mesh, stainless steel mesh, so it doesn't oxidize, but run a high voltage through that, so that basically like an oscillation, low amperage but high voltage, and find a frequency that basically kills the roots without actually, you know, going back up into the root itself, so you could contain the root system that way.
Well, I'll tell you what, Tom, that's something I haven't tried yet. Where people have told me about putting copper pancake coils below the root ball when you plant a plant, and putting the right frequency through it, and it will actually enhance the growth of the plant. But if you put the wrong frequency through it, you're going to end up with a stunted, mutated dwarf.
sounds like one of my cousins.
Now that's something I've never had a chance to try. But I'm really interested in trying, because think about it, how much energy do you need to pulse through a coil below a plant? It's not going to be huge levels of power.
Right. You're not talking about a tremendous amount of electrons. You just want them at a high energized state and just use a small amount of them.
Well, speaking of power, that magnetic ballast that I was talking about earlier, the way that they normally use them is they run them in series with the light bulb. And the way that I'm using it in the video that you'll see, called electromagnet, is I'm running it parallel. And I'm actually running a strand of 120-volt LEDs using that collapsing field. And it actually, the one guy in the little pod that I played to begin with talked about how that these had to have chokes in them because the energy would keep on building up until it finally destroyed the light bulb. So I think that technology, that little anomaly that's going on there, would be a more efficient way to get your lighting if you could build a circuit after it to capture that energy on the way back out, but not allow that energy to go back into the circuit and destroy the whatever you're going to use, transistors or MOSFETs. What do you guys think?
Shaziz, do you know that a lot of these horticultural ballasts, particularly in the amateur markets, have what they call in a super lumen switch?
So, what do? They just allow more higher voltage come through there, or what?
For the last maybe 15 days of your harvest, when you're really trying to get those fruits as large and as healthy as possible, you've got what they call a superlumen switch, which you knock up to the next level. It's like level 11 in Spinal Tap.
So what's it doing? Just like really short pulses so that it's not a long enough duration to burn the bulb out?
Yeah, effectively what it does is if you have a 600 watt ballast, it'll give you 640 watts.
Cool.
Because even that little bit extra is going to increase the light spectrum and penetrate a bit deeper. Because if you're using T5 fluorescent strips, you've got about 12 inches of usable light spectrum depth. Anything lower than 12 inches just isn't going to penetrate the canopy and is wasted. But with the metal halide and high pressure sodium bulbs, you're talking nearly 3 feet. LED lighting, to be honest, it's getting better, but it's still not a touch on the metal halide or high pressure sodium systems, because they cannot penetrate to the level of depth where all leaves on the canopy are getting a reasonable share of the lumens. Now, I've heard a lot of people saying, "Oh, yeah, I'm doing really well with LED bulbs," but I don't see the same yields that you're getting from natural sunlight or from the metal halide bulbs. So, there's a lot of people out there that don't want to admit that their baby's ugly, and unfortunately, the LED light systems currently are still quite ugly. In fact, they fell out the ugly tree and run down the ugly hill, and fell in the ugly river, got washed down shore through the ugly rapids.
Man. Well, my genes must been good, because I make good looking kids.
Yeah. Well, they do say it skips a generation. I'll come and shoot as you ask for that. Yeah, but yeah, there's quite the big noise on the horticultural scene is actually plasma lighting, Shazis.
Well, and that's where I'm going with all this technology that I'm working with. See, the plasma that I'm talking about, using, it's the same thing that's actually going on inside them metal halide, the halogen bulbs or any of these bulbs. You're energizing that gas with a higher frequency, which means you don't have to have a lot of power input in order to be able to do it. It's the frequency that's making the difference. It's the voltage, and the pressure, how fast you're pulsing this thing to energize these deals. And so if you can get, even argon will literally put off a white light if you get it energized to the right frequency. You see what I'm saying? So where there's light, there's heat. And if you can get with just the high voltage alone a lot of heat, then you can take that heat away and then transfer it over into other types of energies. You see what I mean?
Well, Shaziz, I have a little bit of advice for anybody anywhere in the world that's growing various types of vegetables or is experimenting with artificial light. Go to your local cop station and invite your sergeant round for a cup of tea, and go and show him your grow setup. Unless you've a pretty dodgy front door, because when they come and kick it in, they have to replace it when they don't find anything that they don't like. But it will probably be a bit easier just to say, "Look, guys, I'm doing some experiments. I thought you might be interested."
Yeah, because they actually have this forward-looking infrared radar that they fly over top of properties, and they look for heat signatures on crops, and they look for heat signatures in your house. And so if you got a hot spot inside your house and it ain't a furnace, well, they can pretty much tell whether or not you're growing something in there. That's why he says, go tell them before they come kick your door and show them what you're doing.
Well, you know, if you're friendly with the local police, they'll be friendly with you and they won't come in waving guns at you. But what I will say is I did that in the village I was living in, which was probably a pretty good idea because they found a bunch of Chinese guys a mile and a half down the road from me that were growing 800 cannabis plants. They had their own water supply, their own diesel generators to supply the electricity, but they neglected to hide the infrared heat signature. So if you
I'm
do
just wondering
want to
how
try
much nitrogen was coming out of that compound.
Hard to say.
Not very much, because it all went in the plants.
No, the plants put the nitrogen off. That's an old trick that I found out from ages past, that they would hide cannabis crops in with corn crops, because it's hard to spot at night with the UV spectrum. The nitrogen output matches the corn pretty closely.
In the chat room, Barry typed in, how you doing there, Barry? Barry typed in, grow lights make heat. So that excuse me, when you look at any of these gas filled bulbs, you're essentially looking at a plasma reactor. All right, that's as simple as that. The mercury arc rectifier, it was a plasma reactor. If you've ever had the opportunity to see one of these mercury arc rectifiers and you see that that glow inside that deal, that's essentially a plasma reactor. You can see that there's actually plasma being energized inside there by that mercury vapor that was initially heated up. It was a dead short, vaporized it into gas, and then kept on energizing that gas with high voltage AC and built up a lot of pressure, which in turn went out the other end in the form of high voltage DC, because the electron couldn't flow back in the other direction. There was too much pressure going on. Well, using that technology that we've already got and some ideas that I've been talking about running coils through there and circulating either any kind of liquid through that deal, you can actually take that energy away in the form of heat. From that point on, there's many different ways, using thermoelectrics, thermal couples, thermal piles, where you can turn that energy from heat back into usable electricity again. And the whole key to this deal is to basically be able to run your generator without having it fall under Lenz's law, where you're getting the back EMF and it's bogging that generator down and making it work harder. So at the very least, if you do this system that I'm talking about, you're going to end up with a super efficient generator. And you'll still get the same energy that you want out the other side. All you're doing is changing that energy form from the generator to a completely different form, a different state of matter, and then moving it away from the generator so that you're not feeding energy back into the same coils that you're trying to take your electricity out of. That's what my plasma reactor idea is talking about. And the pluses of the deal is, you know, normally heat is what we don't want in a system, because heat normally destroys stuff. Like, that's the reason why transformers end up going bad, is because the heat destroys the coating, the insulation on the wire, which is normally like some sort of thin varnish or epoxy resin or something that basically insulates the coils that turns the wires from each other, so it's not a dead short. But when it gets too hot and that insulation breaks down, then you go from, let's say, 1,000 turns down to a single turn, and you got a fried transformer that you can't use anymore. But if you can keep that transformer cool enough that no matter how much you're running through the other side, but keep that cool enough that insulation never breaks down, then that transformer will last forever. I mean, you won't have to worry about replacing it. So if you got a method by which you can take that heat away from a transformer, see, there's another thing. If you're going to be running a transformer anyway, if they was to modify all these transformers out there, and it wouldn't be that hard to do, that would take away any waste heat, you could still use that heat for something, some other purposes. Even at heating water, if your transformer, let's say hypothetically, your transformer gets up to 100 degrees, all right? And let's say hypothetically that maybe at 130 or 140, the insulation starts to break down and eventually it will destroy itself. So if you can keep that temperature down, number one, that transformer is going to be more efficient. And number two, that even at 100 degrees, if you're circulating water through there, that water will transfer that energy off, and eventually, even if it takes a long time, will heat that water up to that 100 degrees that would normally be considered waste energy. And I've proven this theory because I did a video called Redneck Hot Tub. And essentially, most hot tubs out there are 220 volts AC, and they got a pretty good size heating element in there, whereas you don't have to wait very long in order for the water to come up to operating temperature. The same thing could be done. It just takes you, like, instead of being able to heat it up in maybe 30 minutes, it might take you 4 hours to heat it up. But regardless, as long as you're continuously putting that heat to that water, the temperature will rise up and eventually get there. I've had that hot tub up there heated up in the wintertime within 4 hours, to the extent where you couldn't even sit in the water. That's how hot it was. And all it was a continuous circle of the water being pumped through the coffee pot element and back into the pool over and over again. And it was only using 120 volts AC to do it. So the equivalence of running a coffee pot was enough to bring that water temperature up inside that hot tub hot enough to where even in the winter time you couldn't set in it because it was too hot. So what do you think?
Well, this, just on a slightly different note, guess what type of plasma they're using in the grow lines?
What type?
Sodium.
Well, that's cool.
There's a crowd called Monster Gardens about 6 years ago released a sodium plasma grow light that they claimed would give the equivalent of a 600 watt high pressure sodium bulb using plasma at 350 watts. So nearly they're talking about nearly half the energy.
Well, you know, somebody a long time ago was giving me a rash and talking about how I probably got radiation coming off of those bulbs or x-rays or something like that, and that I was going to fry myself or whatever. But
do you think it was the hair?
Maybe. But even if that was the case, if you found out that there was radiation coming off of there, could you imagine if you had one of those bulbs down inside water and you was transferring the heat from the bulb itself and it basically doing the equivalence of what a microwave oven would do with a high frequency, rocking them water molecules to the point where it finally heats up?
Shaziz, I spent 6 years in Holland working underneath a 1,000 watt high pressure sodium bulbs in Dutch greenhouses growing food without natural sunlight, and I'm still here.
That's my point exactly, and that's what I was trying to tell them back in the day.
Let's get past the actual light spectrum. Let's think about the toroid energy field coming from a 1,000 watt bulb.
Yeah, there's another deal about that is that there's so much energy going on in there. Not only are you getting visible light, but you're getting heat, but you're also getting an energy wave that you can actually capture wirelessly. You know, so there's a lot of energy in plasma. And if you was to use it right, then you could actually, basically, the only thing your generator system would be, your whether it be running on gasoline, a biofuel, or even hydrogen for that matter, or even atomic, it doesn't matter. Whatever is causing your steam power generator to run, you're instead of putting that generator head under a direct load, you just take that energy and start moving it away from the system. Number one, it's going to keep your system from working harder, which means that that system ain't going to heat up as quickly. And if there is any waste energy, it could also be used as well to move away and use it for either heating your house or, you know, water or whatever. You know, that's when you see all these people out there running generators, especially during worst case scenario, if you took and modified that same exact generator before you needed it, all right, to have a radiator cooler system, most of these are air-cooled generators. And once you put that sucker under load to run your electric heater, it bogs it way down. But imagine if you're not putting it under load, you're just using the heat off the engine alone to circulate water through a heater core that is putting the heat in your house. So you still got all that excess electricity left over. You see what I'm saying? I mean, you put it in your car.
If you run two 1,000 watt bulbs, high pressure sodium or metal halide bulbs, in a small house, and you pump the air through vents into separate rooms, you don't need heating in winter.
Well, there you go. See? It's plasma heating right there. But basically what I'm trying to point out is that everything that we're using it so inefficiently, you could get heat off your transformers, you could get heat off your light bulbs. I mean, it seems that heat is the key right there. I mean, if you could control the heat, then you got the alternative energy thing solved altogether. All right, they use heat according to NASA that sent the probe all the way to Pluto. They're using a thermoelectric heating system to essentially create 200 watts of power. All right, well, that's using just plutonium, radioactive material, sending off a frequency as that thing that plutonium is depleting itself. It's releasing that energy, which in turn is heating up those doggone thermal piles, the thermal couples, whichever ones they got in there, and producing electricity. So the same thing could be applied with the plasma technology, because plasma gets hot. I mean, at the core of plasma, it gets really hot. They actually use plasma, which is actually an open-air plasma, that they're cutting through steel with. You see what I mean?
One important thing to look at when you're generating power from heat, though, is that you need a cold sink for that heat to go to. In space, there's one heck of a cold sink out there, especially as far away from the sun as they were getting.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't take much heat to generate a tremendous amount of power, because the second it's generated, it's instantly running away from its source out into that cold void.
So it's not destroying itself. Well, you know, wintertime out there, the same thing could be applied with just your regular air-cooled engine out there. You know, if you took that same doggone engine, you could get the heat off of there and save the electricity for lighting purposes. So all you're doing is using the heat, the waste heat of the generator, to heat your house up. So that's what I'm trying to point out. The same thing you said about the vacuum out there. You know, most of that doggone energy that generator's making is wasted. You know, you're not getting the full potential of what that deal is. Your automobile outside, you know, if there was ever proof of over-unity, the internal combustion engine is proof of over-unity as far as I'm concerned, because if you take away one part from that internal combustion engine, that thing will literally destroy itself. You take away the cooling portion of it, it will produce enough heat that it will literally melt itself down. And so if you could take instead of this being a hindrance, use this doggone heat And even turbine technology. If you ever look into how a turbo charger works on an automobile, it's incredible. They're actually taking exhaust off of the exhaust port and pushing it down through, which is turning a turbine, which in turn is turning another turbine on the opposite side, which is sucking in cold air from the outside, which is then in turn compressed and then goes down through a cooling system that cools down the compressed air enough to shove that compressed air down inside your intake side and give you a boost of power, because now you're shoving a whole bunch of oxygen inside a cylinder where you're trying to ignite your fuel. And you know, that's one of the things that you really need for a good combustion is oxygen. So you're getting one heck of a boost out of the deal. But even in that process that I just explained, you're still building up heat energy from the compression of that cold air that's being sucked inside. So that's pretty impressive, man. But if you took that same technology... Yeah, go ahead.
I had a 1.2 meter by 1.2 meter by 2.2 meter high Groton. I had a 600 watt bulb in it, and if I didn't have a fan that would extract at 300 cubic feet per minute, seriously, it would have boiled the plant.
Cool.
That gives you an idea how powerful some of these lights are. The plasma light itself, they're claiming, it's a claim, I haven't verified it and I can't prove it, but they were claiming that the central element in the plasma lighting system was 5,000 degrees Celsius.
Stephen Gibbons posted a link down there. It said, 1 year, 1 megawatt ECAT trial completed 12 to 50 kilowatts while producing 1 megawatt. That's a link to another alternative energy thing, I believe.
Yeah, the ECAT is an Italian guy that was attempting to reclaim petroleum products from waste back in the 70s, and he was discredited. But the ECAT is very interesting because it seems like NASA has picked up on it.
Well, see, these are the technologies that need to come to the forefront. I keep saying this, man, and it drives me bonkers that we got every doggone thing that we need to literally build an alternative, clean, renewable, green energy device that the whole world could benefit from with just what we talked about on this show, man. And you throw in all these other deals out here. I mean, there were some guys over in Europe that were turning plastic bottles into petrol, man. Gasoline for you Americans that don't know what petrol is.
Come on, Tom's got a few ideas on that as well, Tom, haven't you?
Yeah, I've already discussed that at least a dozen times here on the show, so...
Well,
hopefully somebody's...
I'm just trying to give you now. Some props there, mate.
Well, either way, it's basically taking what normally would be waste that would go to the dump and being repurposed, recycled, you know. And this is the whole key. We waste a lot of energy just building stuff, you know. And if you're going to build it, you might as well build it to last, so that if you're really wanting to reduce your so-called carbon footprint, you'd think you'd make one that lasts the longest time so that you don't have to make very many of them. But that's not how business works, for obvious reasons. We got to make a lot of money, so we got planned obsolescence and make sure that it breaks down.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's just this. Carbonation is usually duplication, because you have a carbon sheet between a bill. So you have multiple copies. So my understanding of the carbon footprint is you get a multiple boot in the backside.
Yeah, I believe it. Hey, Justin, are you in there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Why don't you tell everybody about your Google deal that you put out there real quick?
I don't like to post videos. I like to make well-written reports, because then nobody can argue with them.
Oh, they can.
Well, then you can drive back, right? Then you can drive back.
Yeah.
But, I talk all about electricity and different forms and terminology. I'm really harsh on terminology.
Yeah, I know. We've went toe-to-toe over terminology. You got, like, terminology guy in a good old-fashioned Missouri redneck. Hillbilly, well, or whatever you want to call me. I've been called worse. And well, I'm just trying to explain things in the simplest terms as possible so that the average Joe who's not college-educated could actually understand what it is that I'm trying to say. But, you know, there is a purpose for what you do. Like, for example, somebody has to be able to translate what this guy is saying to that guy, and they don't speak the same language. If you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, but college level, divide that. Like, I never went to college. I'm going to college, but...
I'm just saying, your average college student, they're pretty much stuck to some... Like, for example, you ever go to the doctor and try to read what the doctor writes down? They write it in... what is that doggone language, Thomas? I know you know it. Latin. Is it Latin? No.
What are you talking about?
What do doctors write subscriptions in? There's a language that they use. I think it's not Latin. It's, doggone it. Is that anybody?
No, that's probably, if you're talking about prescriptions, yeah, it's probably Latin.
Yeah, well, your average Joe can't read it, all right? It just looked like a bunch of scribbles in high-tech.
If you've ever dug into it to find, like, just try converting a couple common phrases, like, you know, we came, we saw, we conquered, that kind of turns into a silly-sounding thing, like, Wasaka, or something like that. I don't know, it sounds like you're taking a whiz on somebody, is what you're saying.
Well, either way,
when you translate it to Latin.
Whenever your average Joe wants to read what the doctor wrote, they actually have their own language, essentially, so the patient ain't able to read it. So it's hard to say what your doctor actually says about you. Hey, give this idiot some doggone placebos because he thinks he's sick. You know, the other guy knows how to read
it. Yeah. I'm not against the university education. Some good friends of mine are professors, but not one of them have disagreed with me when I quote Mark Twain, or Samuel Clemens, as he's commonly known, when he said, "I have never let my schooling interfere with my education."
Well, that's brilliant. All I'm saying, I try to put it out there so the average Joe can understand what it is I'm trying to explain to him. Like whenever I explain electricity using plumbing and water, you know, it's all related. And, you know, even Justin, when he talks about electricity, he talks about water. You know, it's the waves that's actually going through the water. You know, it's pretty much the same thing that I'm trying to say. I'm just not using the right words, I guess.
Well, the Mexican wave is best described as putting piezoelectric crystals in those tunnels underneath the border of Texas.
What?
The Mexican.
Oh, okay, yeah. I see what you're saying. Yeah, a lot of traffic. Okay, so...
Everything is water. Everything.
Well, I don't know the full makeup of everything, but what I do understand is that energy travels in waves, and the faster you pulse those waves, the higher the frequency becomes, and the more powerful it becomes. You know, if we actually used electricity to its fullest extent to make it the most efficient way possible, we would actually be using higher voltages than what we are right now, and then, you know, dropping them down from that point, you know, changing the energy to a completely different form of energy that we can, basically what I've been explaining about taking the energy off of the generator without making that generator have to work so hard to do it. So at the very least, you're using less fuel, making it more efficient. at the very best, you end up with over-unity, you know, which is like the golden unicorn, the holy grail of free electricity. I believe it can be done. But until we can actually get people in the shop to prove it, we're just talking about it. You see what I mean?
Shazaz, is that a higher voltage or a higher frequency?
I think it would be the higher frequency, which pluses of higher frequency equals the higher voltage. It's like that magnetic ballast that I was talking about. If you're putting, if you look at my video, you see me tapping a 9-volt battery on there, and I'm getting anywhere from 20 all the way up to, I had it over 100 and some odd volts AC coming up out of a 9-volt battery. You know, at whatever frequency that I tap that, however fast I tap that, would determine how high that voltage goes up there. And there is actually a point where you're tapping it too fast. So there's a sweet spot in there somewhere where you can get the maximum potential of that field collapse, if you understand what I'm trying to say here.
Yes.
You know, if you hit it too fast, then you're actually get to a point where you start losing energy, because you're not allowing that field to completely collapse to gather up all the energy that's coming up out of there. So that's what I was talking about with the Slayer Exciter circuit, which is a really cool circuit. You know, it uses a tip 42C transistor, a resistor, and a couple diodes and some coils, and essentially it's turning the switch on and off really rapidly so that it energizes wirelessly a light bulb, a fluorescent light bulb that is held out there in the air. It's not even plugged in. But the problem that it has is that it goes too fast, because that field is expanding and collapsing in on itself so fast that it doesn't have the time for that expansion. Now, if you could time it out just right, the same exact circuit, put some sort of potentiometer on there where you could turn this thing up and down to get it to the sweet spot, you could find out where the maximum of that field would actually go. And then from that point on, you could replicate that same circuit, and if you know the field is going out, let's say it goes out 6 feet when it's at its sweet spot. At 6 feet, you got a repeater sitting out there that is pushing out its own signal with the same circuit, that those signals are interacting with each other and bumping it out yet even further. So just like a regular repeater system for your radios and your cell phone towers and stuff like that, that's how you're able to talk from your house to, you know, China if you want. That's how it works. Those signals, because of the frequency that they're going at, won't go past maybe 5 miles max. Some of them, some cell phones probably wouldn't even go a quarter mile. You see what I mean?
Shazaz, if you try and film a light bulb running off something like a 600-watt electrical ballast, you can't see it with the human eye, but you will actually see it flickering if you try and take video footage of it.
Yeah. And that's what was going on inside that doggone video that I did yesterday. You could see the fluorescent bulbs, they were lighting up, but it looked like they were intermittent.
Yeah.
You know, it is a 30-minute video, I think, and it's a pretty long video, but it's really got some really important information in there. And knowing that you could take any transformer out there, doesn't matter what transformer it is, and you can pulse it at different, either with a mechanical oscillator, or an oscillator, essentially a switch, all right? It's Tesla sitting there flipping the knife switch over and over. When you flip the switch on, it energizes the coil. When you release the switch, it releases that energy that just got pushed up that coil. It's got to come back. And those are the waves that we're talking about. What do you guys think? Nobody?
Well, to transmit power, you need a completed Tesla coil.
Been trying to tell you forever and a day, Justin, that Tesla coil ain't nothing but it's an antenna, man. It's as simple as that. You know,
it's a receiver repeater because it's only a half of the patent.
Yeah, but you can boost that up if you understand how those waves are actually functioning. And proof of that is what I just explained about the doggone Slayer Exciter.
Yeah, you could make them travel much further, but you couldn't charge something. The time would take too long to charge. You need more amperage on a discharge.
It's like this, man. I've taken everything from static electricity to earth battery technology, and I was able to charge up capacitor banks. And so even if that frequency is a really super weak frequency, if you have a receiver antenna that can pick up that energy as it comes in, so it's going to take you, let's say, 5 minutes to charge up one capacitor, right? Now, if you got a dual system sitting right beside that, it's also sending a frequency out, but just a second or two after the first one goes out. And now your second capacitor down there, it's got a 5 minute cycle as well. So at some point, when you got enough of these in line with each other, you're going to get on demand power on the other side. You see what I'm saying? And you don't have to run them off of multiple sources of input. You can run them all off the same exact input. You just have a timer switch that will, this resistor, this transistor will fire, and then this one will fire, and then so on down the line, like dominoes, and it's sending out these pulses to the same source and charging up multiple capacitors on the opposite side. And with the newer capacitor technology that they got, the supercapacitors, you can charge these things rapidly. And the higher the frequency, the higher the voltage, the higher the pressure, the faster that you can charge those on the other side. So it's not that we can't transmit from one side of the planet clear around to the other, it's that we're not doing it at the right range to be able to do that. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, because a Tesla coil is incomplete. If you take an RT unit and couple it with a waveguide, then you're transmitting sound waves. Sound can turn back into electromagnetic waves with amperage.
Yeah, everything can be.
But you can't just use a Tesla coil with a toroid on top. You need to couple it with a hood and a cup, then go to a toroid. You need to turn it into one directional.
Well, that's why, Justin, one direction. That's why I tell everybody, and it makes people mad, that the Tesla coil is a toy. I mean, it's cool. If you overpower the primary and get that secondary energized to the extent where you're building up all this energy on the top, and then once it finally builds up on the top load and gets enough energy up there to ionize the air around it, it will find the shortest path to ground, including you if you're closer than the iron pole. So it's cool, but there's a whole lot of wasted energy going into that process. That's right,
because you have to put it into a wave guide. The high intensity coming off that toroid needs to be guided.
Yeah, so basically, you're saying pretty much the same thing I'm saying. You tune this thing right, and you can get it to go a whole lot farther for a whole lot less energy input on one side. That's the key to the deal. It's not that they don't have the technology. It's just that they haven't figured out, like the Slayer Exciter, it's being pulsed entirely too fast. Do you realize how fast that switch is turning that power on and off? You know, and everything has a time frame to it. When you pulse a field, it has time that it takes from the energy to get inside that coil and expand that field to its maximum potential. Let's say your 12-volt battery tapped on a coil will expand your field like 3 feet in diameter, perfect sphere. All right, and it takes you 1 second to get it to that maximum potential. And then for that field to collapse, it'll be another 1 second before that field completely collapses in on itself and everything's balanced out again. So if you're expanding this field every half a second, and it takes a whole second for it to collapse from its maximum potential, you see where you start losing there as far as your distance that you could actually transmit? because it's happening too doggone fast. You're sending that field out too fast. It's collapsing because it's not expanding to its max, the 3 feet sphere that I was talking about. It's not making it that far out because it's happening so rapidly that it's collapsing in on itself. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. So it's an incomplete Tesla coil. It's incomplete. It's not. Everybody's basing a Tesla coil off of the worth of power, but nobody follows through with the patent.
Well, build it. Build it and they'll come. Show them exactly how it's done, man. If you got a good understanding of the actual design that Tesla put out there, then build the doggone thing and show it. What I'm saying is,
we've been using these military devices that Tesla gave us for years.
Of course they have. But
radio transmitter coupled to a waveguide,
but
to an antenna that spins around.
But what I'm saying on Tesla technology, one of the biggest things to take away from Tesla's work was the frequencies. The frequencies are the most important portion of that entire deal. How rapidly he's flipping that switch on and off, will determine on how that top load finally punches out until it, break out and energizes the whole room in this big old lightning show.
Well, time and time is makes frequency, and you're right. It needs to be slowed down. If you take a hit and miss engine, 105 horsepower hit and miss engine, try to stop that. Impossible. It's huge, and the frequency is very slow. You can see going tick, 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 but very strong.
Yeah, and another thing to factor in is something that Stephen Gibbons just pointed in there about vortex coils running on sound, verifying Gerard Morin's work, essentially using sound waves to produce energy. But if you actually study the magnetic fields of just a rare earth or even a permanent magnet, whatever, neodymium magnets, if you actually study how these things actually function, and you put like magnet paper over the top of it, you can see that it forms what looks like a toroid coil right there in the magnet paper. And so when you understand that, and you understand how we're actually getting the energy from the magnetism through the copper wire, then you can go from that point on. For example, you can try this out. Get you a transformer, any transformer you got out there, and put your voltmeter on there and measure your voltage with it just running by itself. And put a really strong neodymium magnet on top of that thing and watch that voltage drop out on that thing. Because what's happening is, instead of those electrons being bounced back and forth by either the AC current or a pulse DC current and expanding that magnetic field, the flux lines in there, those electrons will align themselves to the strongest magnetic field. Once they align themselves, everything stops. You see what I'm saying? Everything's balanced out. And so if you could literally figure out how the magnetic field is actually doing the work that it is, I would even venture to say that you might find out that electricity in itself isn't what science books explains. It's the energy that's coming from that magnet itself that is making a difference, because any two magnetic fields will couple with each other and become one magnetic field.
Well, yeah, it's all about the direction and the polarization. See, when we say electron really means positively charged particle. And then if you dig deeper, it means ion. And then what does ion mean? Positively charged water. So learning how to separate the water on a large scale or a small scale in the natural medium, which is the atmosphere, atom in Greek means water, of a sphere, then you can control these functions.
And how we get that energy, how we get some usable force out of that energy, is that we will spin magnets past a coil wire to cause a fluctuation in that wire. And it's how fast we're spinning that rotor will determine the frequency at which this fluctuation is going on, those waves inside that coil. And at certain points, you know, you get a massive voltage spike. Like I took a regular hard drive motor and I spun that thing up to about 35,000 RPMs, and I was putting out some major high voltage, which in turn you got a loss as far as current wise, but you still got a gain as far as pressure wise. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's kind of like putting your thumb over the garden hose. You can spray the water farther when you do that than you could be just to let the water come up out the end of the hose.
Shaziz, I think the big philosophical question here is, it may be high voltage, but is it rock and roll?
Well, yeah. It's only rock and roll, but I like it. Anyway, all we're talking about here is trying to figure out the most efficient way to move energy and to reduce the carbon footprint that everybody keeps crying boo-hooing about over the so-called fake global warming and the doggone bogus energy crisis. We don't have an energy crisis. We've got a common sense crisis. Because if you can take old junk transformers and you can turn them into magnetic ballasts that are amplifying the energy. And it's, when I say amplifying the energy, I'm not talking about, like, you know, the normal concept of amplification. You're pulsing that thing so fast, flipping it on and off, flipping that switch on and off. And what happens is when that wave is collapsing, one wave is coming in, pushing the other one out, and it's raising the pressure up of a higher voltage. Now, can you run your house off of one little deal like that? No, but if you took this anomaly, this concept, and you worked with it, you could build larger magnetic ballast, magnetic coils, or electromagnets. And when that field is collapsing, you're gathering that energy up, and you're not using near as much energy on the input side as you would in order to do it the conventional way. You run 120 to 220 volts AC to run a step-down transformer to run a 9-volt digital clock? Seriously? I mean...
It is.
Yeah.
You know, a 600-watt Lumitec ballast is considered to be more efficient for its light spectrum than a 1,000-watt.
Well, and that's because they got it figured out to where they're pulsing it at the right time. That way, when that wave goes through those molecules of gas, it's gonna cause a reaction. You know, anytime you run a magnet past a piece of metal, you know, or another magnet for that matter, those fields interacting with each other is going to cause a reaction. And every wave out there is in the magnetic spectrum. It doesn't matter whether it's water or gas or anything. It all has its own magnetic poles to it. Now, there are diamagnetic materials out there. You know, there's different materials that react to magnetism differently, such as bismuth and, you know, aluminum as versus copper. You know, there's all kinds of different anomalies that could be expanded on for the right materials to build things out of to get the result that you want. But regardless, all of them, when you pulse a magnetic field, you get a reaction with everything around it. Try putting a magnet near your monitor on your computer and watch how the gas in there reacts. Watch how
that's the differential.
Yeah.
Collapsation and expansion is a frequency.
Yeah, that's what I've been trying to say.
Right. When does that wave become defined as light or sound? Or a solid.
Well, in the...
When does electricity become sound instead of light? See, the transition assigned is 9,192,631,770 hertz. When we use coils, you speak of a word called planned obsolescence. So if institutions are all about planned obsolescence, Why don't we go back to the original generators, which founded this institution, that were created by the man that gave us 60 years worth of writings, Michael Faraday?
Well, my...
A small engine or a small disc in your house can create.
My opinion on that matter is that the generators back there, you know, they still actually got some generators in museums and stuff from back in the old days, and those doggone things still work today.
If we know all this, then why are we still continuing to try to go in the same direction?
This is why I'm pointing out these ballast, transformers, because if you understand how those doggone things function, and that, you know, you see in the video that I talked about, the electromagnet, is that you're turning it into an electromagnet, and it's not just the method of turning it into an electromagnet that's important. It's that when you release that power, in their own laws of physics, energy can neither be created nor destroyed. So where's it going? When you got a 9-volt battery creating an electromagnet, and you cut the power, that should be all there is to it. But that ain't all there is to it, because now nature's going to balance that energy back out, and on that backflow, you're going to get a charge coming back the other direction. And so if you could design a one-way circuit that would allow the energy to go into that coil, but as it was coming back out in that coil, guide it off into a completely different direction, you could take that same doggone concept and get multi-purposes out of it. And that's what I showed in that video. I was lighting up a strand of LEDs, running a tattoo motor, and doing an electromagnet all in the same shot with one 9-volt battery.
Well, a tattoo motor is basically one of the first make-and-break systems of any coil system, which was the rum crop coil.
Yeah, and I was using that tattoo motor as the oscillator. That's how I was able to run the AC current into the doggone LED strand, because the tattoo motor became the switch. It was the oscillator.
Make and break.
Yeah.
You can make a bigger one of those and get really high intensity of voltage from them. They're great machines, as you would call them.
Yeah, and if they were done right, like one of the things you noticed in that video, if you watched it, was that tattoo guns have a problem that if they, because they vibrate, if you leave it laying down on the table, it will vibrate itself out of adjustment. And that's why they got lockdowns to once you get it where you want it, you can turn the lockdown and lock it into place so that it stays there, don't vibrate loose. But even at that, after a while, that lockdown screw will vibrate, and then the other one will vibrate. And then it'll get out of whack, and it's hard to get it back tuned up. But if you built a really good system using springs or even a drop method where the electromagnet is upside down and it picks up a piece of metal, and once that current is dropped, then the metal will drop, and as that falls, and now you're using gravity to create a force as well. You see what I'm saying? One powers it up, picks up the car, and then the other one drops the car. You get a big crash at the end of it. You follow me?
Yep.
So, once you understand those basic concepts, moving on forward to making an actual a solid state generator would be simple using those deals. You wouldn't have to have a rotor. You could actually do a solenoid motor that would actually be more powerful and actually more controllable than a rotor type generator, because all you're using is that pulse and collapse of that field in order to get the energy off the other side if you want.
Well, the heat is created by the reverb, as you say, the expansion and the collapsation. When we expand, we're actually pushing against the natural medium, which is what we call gravity, right? Which is really pressure. So if we're expanding the pressure of the natural medium on that collapsation, it's no different than an atomic bomb going off. You'll see the reverb.
Well, and to add to what you're saying, somebody mentioned, I don't remember if it was today or a while back, somebody mentioned the cavitation where they spin water really fast and those water molecules slamming into each other will actually produce heat, and basically you can boil water. You can turn it into steam by spinning it rapidly.
It's Shaziz, that was me. Oh. And do you know what they use?
Water.
They use it. Yeah, but how do they power the water hammer? What do they use to actually spin it?
An electric motor.
A very low energy DC electric motor.
Well, there you go. And so at some point, when you get enough power to produce steam on the other side, the steam pressure is going to expand multiple times. Water will expand multitudes times itself, its own volume, when it's flashed into steam. And so that steam pressure could turn turbines. It could literally, I believe in fact, but I'm going to go ahead and say in theory, take that steam and run that doggone motor that you used to start it with to begin with.
Even with a low energy DC motor, there's that much pressure being built up by it that they need reflow systems within the pressure tubes, because if they don't have it, it will blow up.
Yeah. Same concept with your internal combustion engine. That car will tear itself apart if you take any portion of the cooling apart. If you take the fan off of there and you ain't got no airflow moving through there enough to take away that doggone heat, the first thing's going to go is your radiator hose, because it's the weakest point. But if you take the entire radiator system and the cooling system out, that thing will generate so much doggone heat it'll break down, the oil seize up the motor and weld itself together, and the motor just flat out destroyed. It'll crack the heads, the cylinder walls, everything. So where most folks look at heat in energy generation as a negative, I am moving us towards using heat as the positive in there, because we know that we can generate heat. Our computers do it all the time, you know, with silicone chips. Those silicone chips will get hot enough to destroy themselves.
Rocks.
Yeah.
Everything is a rock. If you think otherwise, then nothing comes from Jupiter.
Well, you know, every single thing on this planet, there's not one material that we made that nature can't destroy. And when nature's trying to balance itself out, if you're running a lot of voltage through a silicone chip, you're going to get a reaction from the resistance. It's going to get heat, and that thing will burn itself up and start smoking.
Which is the triboelectric effect. It's no different than walking every day.
So
see, if you want to have an idea of gravity and frequency, take one of your feet off the ground and feel what happens to your leg. The leg starts picking up in frequency. It starts shaking because it needs to counter that frequency that's exerted on the body. So if you go high enough, could you levitate, per se?
Well, I believe anything's possible. Once you understand not just the known laws of physics, but once you understand how frequency in itself works, Crazy Russian Hacker did a video here a while back, and basically he took a balloon in a plastic bag, and he took and cut off just a thin rim of the plastic bag, and he took the balloon and rubbed it across his dog's fur to build up static charge on there. Well, he did the same thing with the plastic bag. Now you got two different charges, and he was able to literally cause this doggone plastic bag to levitate over this static charge. You know, it's levitating. You know, if you can figure out the static charge of the earth and the static charge of the atmosphere, could you not be able to do that with something like, let's say, UFO style flying saucer technology? What do you think?
Definitely. It's all due to deflections. What is electrostatic, right? If you get into defining it, really it's just deflection. If you took an object and shook it so fast, violently, it would float.
Well, we figured out in our...
It's deflecting light. It's being relieved of its atmosphere. It was unitary, but now it's an individual.
what we figured out in our understanding of how electricity functions, you know, even just using the electron theory in itself, is that positives attract, or opposites attract, and positives repel each other. And so if you knew the frequency of the Earth in itself, and you had a way to surround yourself with a field that was opposite of what the Earth is, then what do you think is going to happen? You see what I'm saying?
How do you expand your own chi or effluvium that we have? We know we have an effluvium because everything does. It's caused by
density. Well, I hate that word, effluvium.
Right? Everything has a density. Density is created by water. If you take copper, copper has 8.94 cubes of water inside of it, which gives it an effluvium, which is an atmosphere around it.
Well, for sanity purposes, just call it atmosphere.
Well, it's not a sphere.
A bubble.
It's a wire.
Well,
as effluvium.
Anyway, if you know how to fluctuate that same field that you're talking about, you're going to get a reaction. For every action is an equal and opposite reaction. So when you take like a glass of water and you stir it up, you know, you get a rotation going on. You get a spin.
Annulogous current.
And when you shake it up, you get slopped in the face with water. So there's two separate reactions going on there, you know, with pretty much the same amount of force. You see what I mean?
That's what we call folklore currents, right? Every time you take a step, it's an opposite effect on the ground. That means it's a folklore current, an eddy current.
Well, using all these anomalies, we have the answers that we need to literally build the perfect generator systems. Perfectly self-contained, working in harmony with nature, and just doing what nature does best, balancing things out. You know, we charge a battery up. All we did when we charged that battery up is put more energy on one plate or the other than is on the opposite. Now, that energy wants to balance itself back out. And if those battery terminals were close enough, they'd arc across to each other just like a capacitor would. You know, once the pressure builds up in there and it can't hold anymore, it's just like blowing up a balloon. It's going to pop. When it does, that energy will shoot across those terminals and short itself out, and then essentially, you know, nature will balance that energy back out. So when I say crazy things like a dead battery has just as much potential energy as a fully charged battery, I get these doggone electrician people that come from college that look at me all cross-eyed. What are you talking about?
But those people are going to school for money. They're not going to school. Yeah, they might enjoy or be intrigued by it a little bit, but they don't see things for what they should see.
Well, if we're going to make an advancement,
I blew every single one of my mother's breakers out of her breaker box. It's something that I've loved. I'm going to school to not get a job, but to finish what I've started with my church.
Well, there you go. If we ever are to make any advancements in this world, we got to not consider the doggone laws of physics written in stone, because we don't know everything there is to know about everything that is going on around here. But one thing that stands true throughout the entirety of all this energy uses is that you can clearly prove and see physical that energy travels in waves, and the timing of how you pulse it will determine the frequency of the energy on the other side. So with that said, Muddy, looks like Muddy joined us. Are you in there, brother?
Yeah, I'm in here. Good morning, doggone it.
So did you catch any of what we're talking about?
Yeah, the wife has effluvium right now.
That ain't good. They got
no.
Use some Theraflu.
Yeah.
That's good stuff. Theraflu. It tastes like lemon sodium water. But it'll knock the symptoms.
And yeah, I'm not much into those magnetic generators and all that. I understood Larry's. Now that dog doggone 2-hour plus interview out of him. It was wonderful. Basically, about the only thing I got going here right now is catching up on the bills and all that stuff. But I did make one of them nebulizer type things. I had one of those piezo elements that go under the water, and LEDs are on it, and it actually vibrates at 54 hertz. Came from Patrick Bunnyville. And we put that into a container, a gallon grape juice container, and put it into the bottom there, and put the water in. We put a heap of baking soda up into it, and that thing put off a mist like you wouldn't believe. And shoot, beats going to, you know, and spending a few hundred dollars at the doctor to get the same thing. Yeah, that's basically all the stuff that's dried up, clogged in the lungs, loosened up, cleared out. And
well, not only is
I got cured pretty quick. Now, she's just a little bit behind me on all that because she's been out there in the cold night throwing all the papers and stuff.
Not only is that got a good health aspect to it, using what Raymond and I was talking about quite some time, those misters turning the water molecules into smaller molecules would actually be good for hydrogen technology.
Right. Now think about those, like that Chantilly glass where they got a 5-gallon jug and 2 carbon rods and you adjust them. If you put 36 volts on them, like 3 car batteries in series.
Yeah.
And you bring that the 2 carbon rods together till they arc, and then you spread the arc. And that water looks like a rapid boil. Puts out liters per second. Comes out there. The only difference between it and HHO is this has carbon monoxide in it. Until you burn it. And then you burn it. And the main output gas is oxygen. So once it's burned, it's pretty cool. So, I mean, that being in a mist or something, I haven't played with electrifying a mist, but I do have a friend who worked in the Navy, and he told throwing water on an electrical fire is a no-no.
That's hydrogen explosion.
Yeah, so what I see between the Chantilly gas and you've got an electrical deal and you throw water up on it, I'm pretty sure it turns into a lot of vapor as well.
Well, if you throw in the mix that what you're talking about right there, a turbocharger and how those things actually function, one of the things that I don't believe these guys are recognizing whenever they're doing it, they understand the concept of how the thing basically works with a turbocharger using the exhaust to spin a turbine, which in turn sucks cold air in from the outside, and the compression of that cold air actually heats up to the extent where they got to put a cooler to cool the air back down before they ram it down into the intake. But one of the things I don't think they're realizing is they're actually sucking moisture out of the air that is helping that boost inside that turbocharger. So there's actually some hydrogen production going on in there. Even if it seems small, it don't take much hydrogen because of the way that this stuff is pretty volatile.
Well, don't forget about the supercharger. The supercharger actually does all of that, and it throws a water mist down into it.
Well, there you go.
That makes it go even better. They blame it on the compression because water doesn't compress. But I think it's more than that. I think it actually does ignite and expand and ignite all in the same throw.
Well, imagine you got a generator running on hydrogen, all right, and then you turbocharge that hydrogen generator. Man, you're going to get some amazing torque out of that thing, all right. If you could build this generator good enough to where it doesn't tear itself apart, you'd have the most efficient, most powerful generator that even if you were running inefficient stuff on your generator head, it'd have the power to overcome that. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
So, with that said, if you built the right hydrogen car, it could be a combination hydroelectric car where you actually have an electric motor that is your power source, But you're using a hydrogen engine in order to run a generator that is keeping that motor going. So you see, it's like kind of like the gas electric hybrids, where they'll charge up the batteries and then the gas engine will shut off and so on and so forth. Well, you could have a full-time hydrogen engine running, and it's charging up batteries that are running an electric motor on demand. And some of these electric motors that they got these days are just ludicrous how fast you can get them to go.
Right. Any of them electric car conversions, me and Thomas were talking last night while I was staying up late. We were talking last night about the electric cars. A lot of people don't know where to put the gear ratio set at. And usually what I've found from all the conversions prepared for the regular cars and stuff is first and second gear are the only two gears used. So the electric motors actually spin pretty much twice as fast as the engines do. So, and the good thing about electric motors and conversions on those is the torque is the same torque at the bottom end that it is at the top end. They still have the same torque all the way through because of that's with how much power you're putting into, because that's how strong the magnetic pull is.
Yeah. Well, if we can understand how an electromagnet works and how a magnetic field actually functions when it expands and it collapses, and we can monopolize on that specific anomaly along with everything else that it is that we're talking about, you know, everything from hydrogen technology to thermoelectrics to hydroelectrics, steam power, all these things in conjunction with each other, there is no reason whatsoever under the sun that we couldn't literally build a car that would be self-contained, self-powered. It could pull its fuel right out of the air while you're driving down the road, man. You go through a humid climate and you condense that humid climate into dehumidifiers that you buy for your house. You got the doggone car itself generating the energy to run a dehumidifier, sucking moisture right out of the air and dropping that moisture down into a condenser, which is pouring it down into your fuel tank, and you never even run out of water.
Right. Yeah, the main thing, dehumidifier is nothing but an air conditioner.
Yeah.
It's not set to cool the air.
Well, there you go. Another key point is you can use the condensation off your air conditioner. You can still run your AC in the car and then capture that water as it's coming off of there. Because it's hot outside, it's cold in your car, you get condensation built up. And normally when you park your car, you'll see water dripping out from underneath your AC unit. So there you go, man.
How many times have you walked up to a car and just seen, not just dripping, I mean, it's usually going drip, 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 but I have seen a steady stream come up.
Oh, yeah. They actually got little tanks that gather that up so that it can guide it down a hose that won't spray it out all over the side of your engine while you're driving.
Yeah, so, but going down the road on a motorcycle, follow a Cadillac, man. Follow a big car. I tell you what, riding behind them, man, you can feel the water droplets off that air conditioner. You'll find just the right spot where you get sprayed with a little water continuously. It will cool you down.
Yep. So as far as
I tell you, that brings another important deal. If we got off these stupid petroleum vehicles, which put off a lot of heat. Did you know that the average temperature on the weekends, when the cars are all flying all over the place, taking their one day off, it's basically like 2 or 3 degrees warmer than the weekdays.
Well, Justin's hypothesis about everything being water is correct. You're transferring that heat to the atmosphere surrounding you, so basically, wherever there's a lot of traffic, there's a lot of heat. And you know you got radiant heat off the exhaust, so it's going to be hotter down in the city where there's a whole bunch of cars running than it is going to be out in the country where there ain't very many.
City's always warmer, and I did have that backwards. That's weekdays, people in traffic jams.
But
if we got electric cars.
If you have a way...
We wouldn't have half the global warming problem.
Well, either way... If you
electric
could,
cars eliminates obsolescence and power equals money.
Either way, if you could monopolize on that waste heat, which is the engine and running, the waste heat that's coming off the engine itself, there is a whole lot of wasted energy potential. You know,
yeah, only 5% of that combustion in that chamber makes it to your back wheels.
Yeah.
So everybody's got a little fire going down the road and polluting.
Well, the guys that run the turbocharged cars have proven they can get double the horsepower off of the stock motor just by adding a turbocharger to it, because it takes some of that waste heat energy and puts it back into the doggone engine, which gives it a boost.
Well, the turbocharger, same thing as a rocket stove, makes your fuel more efficient. It doesn't mean that it's not running hotter. It is. So you're getting more bang for each flame, because for each measure of fuel, but that's still translated into heat and expansion.
Well, either way, then you take that doggone heat and use a heat exchange system of some sort to generate more electricity and supplement your doggone alternator so it don't have to work as hard. You know, there's just, it's unlimited. You know, that's why I say, if there was ever a proof for over-unity, the doggone internal combustion engine's that. Because if you take one thing away from that thing, that energy that motor will generate in the form of waste heat alone will destroy that engine.
Oh, yes.
So, we can take all these things that we know about, and like was mentioned earlier in the show, if you have a gasoline generator and you're, let's say the power grid goes down and you're going to be running electric heaters with that doggone gasoline generator, number one, you're going to use more fuel and you're going to waste more energy. It's going to make that generator have to work harder. However, if you modify that, what would have normally been an air-cooled motor, to a water-cooled motor, then you can take that heat off of there and you can heat your house with the heat off of the generator instead of the heat off of the doggone electric deal, leaving your electric portion for your lighting and whatever else you have to run. You see what I'm saying? And
yeah,
you could actually use the heat off of that motor for your cooking purposes as well, because, you know, we're going to talk about surface area here. You know, a shorter surface area means you're going to gather up more heat a lot quicker on there, so you could actually build a copper tubing system with just a smaller amount of water in there that's going to get a heck of a lot hotter. And that is, you know, I was talking to Steve and I asked him if he thought 180 degrees was enough to cook something on.
Redirect for radiance.
Yeah.
Oh,
so
yeah,
you could turn that one generator into a super efficient generator, still burning fossil fuels. I even hate the word fossil fuels, but still burning gasoline in the doggone deal, and get more usage out of there than you would be for just an average, like a 3,000 watt generator. If you're using a couple thousand watt doggone electric heaters, you've already sucked up most of your power, your electric power that you needed. But if you're not using the electric heaters, and you're using the heat, the waste heat off that engine to heat your house, man, I don't know if y'all ever remember being inside a school bus whenever the school bus got up to operating temperature, but a 65-passenger bus has multiple heater cores in it and multiple fan systems.
Oh, so, yeah. I remember them underneath the seats of the bus.
Yeah. Once you got that thing up to operating temperature, that heater would literally run you out of there, man. School buses will operate up as high as 220 degrees Fahrenheit. That's hot.
All right? It's under pressure.
Yeah, and so that heat being transferred all the way back through a hose, all the way back to all these different heater cores circulating through there, when it gets up to operating temperature, if it's enough to heat up an uninsulated school bus, it's more than enough to heat up an insulated house. You see what I mean?
That's right.
So there you go. A part of your alternative energy deal out there is to get control of your heating. That's one of the most important. You wouldn't have to burn firewood if you used, you know, basically going back in time and using the old radiator style systems, or the same system that your automobile uses to heat your car could heat your house. If you had a diesel engine And you could modify some ports on the side of that car to where it's like, you know, easy connect and disconnect, to where you could actually circulate antifreeze through a radiator system. You could pull your diesel car up next to the house, plug it into your heating portion of the house, leave the car running while you're going to bed, and then turn around and heat your house with it. Of course, you'd have to make sure that you ain't getting none of your exhaust inside the house. You ventilate it away from the house, or, you know, some sort of filtration system, so you ain't getting carbon monoxide. But you get the point. The point is, you're using the waste heat off of that motor, and since the diesel engine has oil mixed in the fuel, it self-lubricates the pistons, as opposed to the gasoline engine, where you don't want them idling too long by themselves, because they'll literally, the rings will wear grooves into the cylinders and it'll start running really bad and tearing up the cylinders.
Yeah, and the next time you drive erratically rather than the way that you normally do, it tries to pass that groove on the rings.
Yeah, and then brakes.
That's when you get some bad engine wear. Oh, the point you made here, fossil fuels. I always thought that fossil fuels would be rocks, but it's not. It's rotten fuel.
Yeah.
It's fermented and it went down and turned it into basically a Mother Nature's chemistry set. Has taken all the oils and put them together and stored all that energy. I'm with you on the fossil fuel. I never liked the word myself.
Stephen Gibbons typed a joke inside the chat room, but I don't get it. Somebody explain it to me. It says, two men walk into a bar. One man orders H2O. The other says, I'll have H2O too. The second man dies. What did I miss?
Carbon monoxide. Chantilly gas.
Oh!
He's on the ball today.
Right on.
No, he said that he basically had two people that ordered. One ordered water and the other one ordered hydrogen peroxide.
Ah.
O2.
They
change T-O-O to T-W-O.
See, that's why it's good
since
to have
they sound the same.
A chemistry guy on the table there.
Yeah,
that's funny now. It's funny now that I understand the joke. Ha ha.
Yeah. He drank pure hydrogen peroxide, so.
Yeah.
Oh, which actually reminds me of something that probably could be considered a joke, too. I have a friend that was switching his teeth after brushing and whatnot, right? Trying to avoid furthering a cavity that he had. So he was using hydrogen peroxide, and he accidentally swallowed a cap full of the stuff. And he was like, uh-oh, that's, you know, a chemical. And he read the side of the bottle and said, you know, if you accidentally ingest this, call poison control. And so he called poison control. He's like, yeah, I had some in my mouth. I accidentally swallowed this this peroxide. And you're like, a little bit of silence then. Now imagine somebody who thinks they've just swallowed poison and they think they're dying. And they call the people who are supposed to help them, and that's all they hear from the other end of the line is laughter.
Well, that would stink.
Right. when they finally calmed down, they said, look, large quantities, small children, yeah, that might be a problem. You're a full grown man, a small cat, you'll be fine. Don't worry about it. Just going to make a little gas.
Yeah, actually it's supposed to help you a little bit too. So.
Well, either way, you know, on the alternative energy side of the spectrum right there, there's a lot out there. These magnetic ballasts that I'm talking about, you can make them out of old transformers. And if you built the proper circuit that would allow the energy to come in to charge the circuit, and then that collapse happens, and then it sends it off, not back into the circuit, but directs it off a different direction, that, in my mind, would be more efficient than trying to use a secondary coil under. You could actually do it with just one primary. So it's worth looking into. You see what I did with the tattoo gun in that video. I actually used the tattoo gun motor as an oscillator to turn the pulse it off and on like it did to get the AC current to run the strand of LEDs. Pretty cool. And so I was getting three Three for the price of one off of the 19-volt battery. I was getting an electromagnet. I was running the doggone tattoo gun and lighting up some LEDs all in one shot off of the same 9-volt battery. Now, there ain't nothing to say that you couldn't actually build a cord to while you were running your tattoo gun and giving somebody a tattoo to use that same process to light up the light that you're actually using to see to make the dead burn tattoo. So, you see what I'm saying? Using it more efficiently. That's the whole key to alternative energy. Clean, renewable energy. What do you guys think? Did I lose you? Silence is deafening. We need that cricket sound again. All right, well, don't everybody jump to the microphone at once. Don't want nobody to chip a tooth. But hydrogen technology, we can get hydrogen on demand. It's already been proven, you know. And if we don't just throw our eggs in one basket and just use hydrogen, if we use all these other anomalies that we know about and add them together and use even the waste heat that is going to be produced by combustion. I mean, what do you got to lose, man? You end up with water out the other end of the tailpipe, which you can use for fuel again. What do you think?
Mm-hmm.
So here we are.
Not having to refuel your tank is pretty much the goal there.
Yeah. Here we are in year 2016. Let's figure it out, folks. I mean, biofuel, yeah, people running around in Volkswagen old VW vans burning biodiesel.
Save that money you're spending on your energy bill so that the government can go ahead and raise their taxes and extract that out of your bank account.
Or take all your money and run with it and go buy you some more stuff to make you even more efficient.
Well, that's not going to happen if somebody gets greedy and tries to basically spread it around so the government finds out about it. Because the second somebody that is used to leeching off you finds out you have more blood, they're going to send more leeches.
Well,
got to keep them out of the know.
That's why I wanted to put this information out there to the average Joe and the way that I'm doing it so that, you know, when it comes down to it, you'll know exactly what it is I'm talking about. I mean, if you can't watch my channel and figure out some anomalies that are going on, I don't care about the one anomaly by itself. I mean, it's important. It really is important. It's one of the pieces of the puzzle. You know, because that one anomaly by itself, such as, you know, being able to light up LEDs or fluorescent bulbs, all right, that's not enough energy to run your house because your house is set up so inefficiently that you're wasting more than you're using. But that one anomaly could run your lighting system, taking that off the grid. You know, you could use the waste energy off of any transformer to literally run your lighting. So while you're going to be running your electric fan anyway, why not take that energy off of that electric fan and having it run your light? Every time you turn the fan on, the light comes on. All right? Because no matter what's happening, whether it's an AC current or a direct current, any of the pulse DCs, it's when that field expands, it's going to collapse. When it collapses, you catch that energy on the backslide and you use that energy for something. And you can store that energy. If it's AC current coming out and you rectify that AC current coming out, you end up with DC current that you can charge up capacitors and battery banks. In turn, run inverters off of it. So you could take existing things throughout your entire house and you can slightly modify them just enough to where instead of that energy just kind of going back and balancing itself out, you capture it. It's as simple as that. And it's not even going to change the function of what it was to do to begin with. All it's going to do is collect that collapsing field as it's going back, which in other words would have just been wasted energy, just like the wasted energy on your heat in your car, you know?
Or the wasted energy coming out of most politicians' mouths.
Well, yeah, if you could put thermal couples on their in front of their face, thermal piles or Peltier elements, heck, man, you could generate some lights or something.
Yeah, I was going to say, you get in front of Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, you could basically capture that waste energy and float a whole platoon of hot air balloons.
Yeah, the politicians are winning a hot air balloon race.
Well, I think that I'm sitting here trying to read a message.
I'll start calling him Donald Quark.
I think that there's a lot of people out there that's got a lot of good ideas as far as like Raymond's work and coils and systems and stuff like that. And even the Bedini motor and the way that it functions, the Tesla coil, the hydrogen technology, static motors, the Slayer exciter, all of these things in conjunction with each other, the Lord Kelvin generator, the Van de Graaff generator, the Wimshurst generator, all of these things in conjunction with each other is just doing one thing. It's moving energy from one point to the next. It's throwing nature off balance, and when nature snaps back, that's when you get the snap, crackle, pop. You see what I'm saying?
Into your morning.
Yeah.
Just
the lightning bolt.
All those machines and all that you just said there influence machine and particle accelerator.
Well, yeah, but they're sending out an energy wave.
And one's the piezoelectric effect.
When that energy wave goes out and it hits the fluvium, like you like to call it. All right, well, it's going to rebound. It's got to rebound. For every action is an equal and opposite reaction. When it hits an opposing force, when you slam face first into the wall, you slam back first into the floor, because that reaction's going to bounce you off the floor. And if you got enough momentum to do it, you can set them ricochet off of each other until you're just a pile of mush in the floor.
That's right. So when you're playing with the natural medium, you're really playing with the emissions of the light source, the sun.
There's energy. We're floating in a sea of energy.
That's right. When you're playing with static electricity or electrostatics, then you're moving the emissions, the pressure of the natural medium.
Well, the key is to be able to use it efficiently enough to where you're not polluting. And we don't have to use all kinds of acidic materials to build things. We can use natural chemicals, for example, just a basic simple science. If you take any citric acid fruit, like a lemon or a lime or a grapefruit, and you put in two dissimilar metals in there, you actually produce electricity, you know.
Why? Because that acid is seeking out what? Water, right, Thomas?
It's the acid and the base. Yeah, I will say that. No, the acid and the base basically have an opposing charge.
Yeah, and it's trying to balance itself out.
Right.
So, with that said, there you go, man. Once you understand that that's exactly what nature's doing, no matter how you're using this energy, when you pulse it out, nature's going to set it back where it was to begin with. So, you use that rubber band effect to get some work done in the process. It's as simple as that. Now, I don't know how much more simple that a person can say it. You know, it's just that the way that we're doing it right now, we're wasting more energy. Our ballasts are so energy efficient, you're not getting the full potential of what that energy is capable of because you're not using it properly. And if you know that you can energize a gas into the plasma state using high voltage, and you know that if the voltage is high enough that you can literally generate a massive amount of heat, that you can in turn take that heat away and change that heat into a completely different form of energy back into usable current again, then you got no reason why you couldn't take your average Joe generator and turn it into a super efficient generator at the very least. And if it's running off of water, like a hydrogen engine, then you recapture that doggone water out the exhaust, bring it down in through a condenser, and have it fed right back into the doggone deal. And one of the things about doing that, while you're feeding that exhaust through a condenser system, if you have it vented properly, it will actually be sucking moisture out of a humid climate inside as well and adding even more fuel to the doggone fire. So it ain't that it can't be done, it's that you gotta get up and do it, folks. Seriously. We got it, all the answers. If I can get the dream team together, if we can all just get in one doggone shop when it has all the machines.
We can all just get along.
Yeah. You guys and gals out there want this clean, renewable, alternative energy to reduce the so-called carbon footprint. Support your local mad science guy and researchers out there in any way that you can.
Well, that's what I'm doing. I'm not out there looking for anybody. I'm building and providing a shop for everybody. I'm not about gathering people, because when the time comes,
maybe it'll be your shop that we prove this in, Justin. I'm just saying. I see. Here's the deal. I'm not a good salesman. You know, I couldn't sell gold to the guy searching for it. All right, I'm a lousy salesman, and I'm not a good machinist. What I am good about is understanding mechanics and how they function and other alternative uses for it. So I got my piece of the puzzle that I can add to the table. You know, as far as financial-wise, you know, I won't ask for money. I won't ask for donations, because of principle, I told everybody that I'm going to prove once and for all free energy, and that means that I'm not going to sell any doggone plants to nobody. If I come up with a working device on my own without getting into this shop with the dream team that I've been talking about, I'm going to put it out there for the public for free. Flat out. Open source, and that's it. It's a done deal. I'm not looking to get rich. I'm not looking to get famous. I'm just looking to keep my word to the power company. You see what I'm talking about?
Got a question for you.
Yeah.
If every time we come up with an invention, they find a way to use it for a disaster, and if we come up, you come up with an invention and you share it with the world, the big guys up there, me and Thomas were talking about this last night. This is his theory and idea. The big guy up there will use it to make sure that he's on top of you again, and you're still in the same position.
That invention is basically nothing more than you have been starved by your slave masters to the point where basically your neck has shrunk and you can wriggle out of your shackle and you run around if you put it out there publicly so that the big corporations and the government sees it, then that's basically you running up to the slave master and saying, hey, give me a better bed to sleep in and I'll show you how I got out of the shackle so you can shrink it down and make sure no one else gets loose.
Well, that's like the invention of the shoestring, right? Everybody on this planet pretty much who owns a pair of shoes knows what a shoestring is. Is a shoestring high tech? No. But it's got, you know, a nifty little plastic tip on there that keeps it fraying out. So there was another guy that invented that plastic tip, both of which probably made a few bucks off of the whole process. And you know what happens if you get thrown off in jail or something like that? They want to take your shoestrings. They don't want you to be able to have your shoestrings. You might try to hang yourself or hurt somebody, make a slingshot or some kind of stuff. So
if you do a heist, make sure you got them Velcro shoes.
Yeah. But regardless of all that, the key to take away from the shoestring example is this. Everybody on the planet knows what a shoestring's for. Everybody on the planet knows how to use a shoestring. Everybody on the planet needs a shoestring if they got shoes on their feet, unless they're wearing cowboy boots or slip-ons or Velcro like Muddy's talking about. But regardless of all that, the Pandora's box is open.
Buckle and strap.
The knowledge is out there, and if you can't go to the store and buy a shoestring, then you go out there and find you some hemp and twist your own twine and make you a shoestring. You see what I mean?
Well, it sounds like what you're trying to say is you can't escape the slave master, so just give in.
No, I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is you put the information out there and everybody knows about it. Once the information is public knowledge and everybody and his brother knows it, you know, it's like the first guy that figured out that if you put a rope on a bucket, you can drop it down the well and get water out. Before that, what did they do to get water? All right, but once they knew that, everybody knew that. And now you got technology to where you can dip your water, your bucket down in the water and get something to drink. You know, same thing with electricity or anything else out there that you want to do. You put that knowledge out there in everybody's head. When it becomes common knowledge, there ain't no way. You can't sell a widget if everyone out there on the planet owns a widget already. You see what I mean?
No, but you can be forced to make that widget and use it for the guy who's got a gun.
Well,
until your widget breaks anyway.
Then you go out and build you another one because you got the knowledge.
Oh, yeah, if you got the knowledge to build it, they just basically hit you in the back of the head with the butt of the gun and say, hey, build another one.
Well, you know, poke them in the eye with your widget.
Then you got five guys with guns that are there basically shooting you in the head. You know? You poke them and poke one guy in the eye and you get five bullets in the
head. All right, look, so look, there's all kinds of negatives out there, but we got to have a little bit of bravery if we're going to move forward into the whole entirety of a better world. If we're going to network with one another, we got to get past the fear of whether or not the government's going to kick our door.
Listen, let's bring it full circle, okay? If you do figure out how to wriggle out of your shackles, are you going to go tell the slave master so you can get a better bed?
No, I'm going to tell the people.
No, listen. If you do that, somebody's going to want that bed, and they're going to go run off to that. If you run off and set up an underground railroad so you can then start sneaking the other slaves out and show them how one at a time how to get out of that that shackle, as soon as you know which ones aren't going to go run off and tell the slave master so that they can basically get that better room, most of them are going to want to leave. It's not that hard to figure out who wants to leave.
Well, the whole key about this whole deal is I got my own underground railroad, so to speak, with my mad science and my YouTube channel, because I've already told all these people, and they go out around and they tell their people who tell their people and so on and so forth. So by the time it gets back to the slave master, it's already too late. Too many people already know about it, and you can't shut them up about it. You have to go around and find out everybody who got the secret and shut them up that way. Which, in that sense, you're talking genocide, and so that's going to not make too many people happy when people start getting whacked over the widget. Anyway, where there's a will, there is a way. You know, we have all the answers. That was interesting. That's like one of them doggone Twilight Zone things, man.
Stepping into the Twilight Zone?
Yeah. That was a cricket hollering down a sewer pipe. Anyway, we're down to the wire, guys. If you guys have an opportunity, we can either take this up or a new topic on the Knights of the Round Table tomorrow if you guys are interested. Everybody, you've been listening to the Mad Science Show. Check out this latest video that I did called Electromagnet. It is a long video, but if you understand what it is I'm trying to show to you, and then you go back and you look at all the other videos that I showed, different anomalies. Now, keep in mind that one by itself isn't going to run your entire house, but you add to the one to the other, and now you got a little bit more efficient system, and you take all these anomalies, all these basic science, the pop-pop boat, you know, you can make a solid-state motor that run off of burning some charcoal out of your grill and be able to run this motor around without no moving parts. All right, all these little basic science toys that you've seen throughout the history of time, some of the best toys, some of the best science were the older toys that were out there. So if you ever get an opportunity to go out there and look at toys that were based off of scientific principles, even the submarine that used baking soda to go up and down, it was a cool toy. They actually used to give them away in cereal boxes at one point in time. But all these things, piezoelectrics and yo-yos that used to light up whenever you spin them and things like that, all of these anomalies that I like to call them, all of these effects in conjunction with one another could build the perfect generator that would work in perfect harmony with nature without polluting anything, just using what we know that nature already does on a regular basis, and that's balancing everything out. You know, you tilt the water to one side, it's going to run back to the other side. Water always finds its level, and so does electricity. It's as simple as that. So you guys got anything last you want to say before we peel up out of here?
Yeah, there was a guy that built a pyramid house. And he had this long wire that he had from the peak of it. Some people don't think there's much in the pyramid power. But one day he decided to connect this wire to a ground wire and see what kind of current he got. Well, when he touched the long wire, it knocked him across the room. So, yeah, there is pyramid power. That's another concept and something to study and check out.
Yeah, and you'll find in one of my videos, I have an aluminum pyramid hanging above the coils and stuff, and it's a perfect antenna for picking up radiant energy, and you can actually see that whenever I got one of those fluorescent bulb starters hanging there, you grab a hold of that, and it produces plasma inside that bulb.
Well, let's get a weather balloon and bring that pyramid up a little higher.
That'd be cool. So what about you, Justin? You got anything last? No? Did he already peel out? Thomas?
Sorry, I'm back. I was playing with the dog.
Well, yeah, he was playing with his
I
snake.
Was asking for a last comment. We got to go. We're starting to run over. Nothing?
Nope.
Going once? What about you, Thomas? All right, I guess Thomas ain't got nothing else either. So with that said, you all been listening to Mad Science Show. Stay tuned for the Knights of the Round Table, 8 a.m. Central to 11 a.m. Central time. Just show up and join in the chat room, become an honorary knight, or actually call in on Skype. Same username, Shaziz. Just add me as a contact on Skype, call in, become one of the Knights of the Round Table. We just ask everybody to be respectful to one another. It's all about passing good, positive knowledge and throwing positive pebbles in the pond. Peace and love, everybody. Take care.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission:
to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap!
Operator, give me the number for 911.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.